You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you, Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. It's difficult to know where to begin today when speaking about what's been happening in an area that has been much in my mind for the past 45 years. In the summer of 1970, I spent 4.5 months on a photographic assignment in Lebanon and Jordan. It was to document the life struggles and growing resistance movements among Palestinians in the refugee camps created following their expulsion from their homeland, most in 1948, as a price for the new state of Israel, and others in 1967, when Israel conquered the West Bank and expanded to the Jordan River. I would not be back in Lebanon until the fall of 1983, a year after Israel sent 80,000 soldiers across the border on the pretext of destroying the PLO, which had nothing approaching an army. That invasion, now largely forgotten in the West, took the lives of close to 20,000 Lebanese and Palestinian civilians, not including those massacred at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps by a Lebanese Christian militia under the watchful eye and with the support of Israel's occupying army. That October 23rd, not long after I had arrived, I was awakened at 6:15 in the morning by the vibration of what I took to be a huge explosion. The U.S. Marine base, a mile away and next to the Beirut airport, had been destroyed by a massive truck bomb, leaving 241 dead. 15 minutes later, an apartment house not far away, which served as a barracks for the French peacekeeping forces, was turned into a pile of rubble by another truck bomber, with 58 dead. The U.S. and its Western allies claimed, without any proof, that the attacks were organized by Iran and carried out by suicide bombers from Hezbollah, which was then in its infancy as a resistance movement to Israel's occupation. There were, however, amongst almost as many questions raised among Lebanese and some foreign journalists about the circumstances of both attacks as there were about 9/11, questions, like those about 9/11, that have never been satisfactorily answered. But that's not the reason for my bringing up the story. It's simply that in watching the bodies being carried out from the Marine barracks and seeing the corpses being lifted from the rubble of the building that had housed the French troops, I sensed that what I had witnessed was the future of our planet, which is what I told friends upon my return to California. And so it has come to pass. At about 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be going back to Lebanon, which has seen many suicide bombings since, but via Skype, to speak about the subject of ISIS or Daesh, but from a very different perspective than you may have heard yesterday from President Obama and French President François Hollande, or that you will hear or read in our mainstream media. We'll be discussing the implications NATO member Turkey shooting down a Russian fighter jet yesterday as it was presumably ready to carry out attacks against anti-government forces. I will be speaking with Lebanese American activist Rania Masri, who I've interviewed several times before on Takes on the World. It should come as no surprise that the deadly attacks in Paris, November 13th, have been seized upon by Washington's chicken hawks. One of them, Robert Kagan, as a co-founder of the Project for New American Century, or PNAC, was a major promoter of America's devastating war in Iraq, whose legacy we are dealing with today. He also served as a foreign policy advisor to John McCain during his presidential run, and now, more importantly, he is doing the same for Democratic presidential contender Hillary Clinton. Many of you will remember that part of PNAC's declaration back in 1997 was that what was required to get the American public behind a war to oust Saddam Hussein and establish unchallenged U.S. dominance over the Middle East, with Israel at its side, of course, was a Pearl Harbor-like event. Very conveniently, they got it, with the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Now, 18 years later, having never apologized for what he had helped unleash upon the planet, Kagan is at it again. Writing in last Saturday's Wall Street Journal, Kagan was arguing for aggressive U.S. intervention to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Given his influence on what may be our next president and the likelihood that she may appoint him to a critical foreign policy position, it's important to know what advice Kagan is likely to pass on to her. So here's a taste of it. Addressing his proposed U.S. intervention, Kagan rhetorically asked, what would such an effort look like? Well, first, it would require establishing a safe zone in Syria, providing the millions of would-be refugees still in the country a place to stay, and the hundreds of thousands who have fled to Europe a place to which to return. To establish such a zone, American military officials estimate, would require not only U.S. air power, but ground forces numbering up to 30,000. Once a safe zone was established, many of those troops could be replaced by forces from Europe, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and other Arab states, but the initial force would have to be largely American. In addition, writes Kagan, a further 10,000 to 20,000 U.S. troops will be required to uproot Islamic State from the haven it has created in Syria and to help local forces uproot in Iraq. Many of those troops could be replaced then by NATO and other international forces to hold the territory and provide a safe zone for rebuilding the areas shattered by Islamic State rule. At the same time, says Kagan, an internationally negotiated and blessed process of transition in Syria should take place, ushering the bloodstained Mr. Assad from power and establishing a new provisional government to hold nationwide elections. The heretofore immovable Mr. Assad, he says, would face an entirely new set of military facts on the ground. With the Syrian opposition now backed by U.S. forces and air power, the Syrian Air Force grounded and Russian bombing halted. But how exactly, he doesn't say. Throughout the transition period and probably beyond even the first rounds of election, he goes on, an international peacekeeping force made up of French, Turkish, American, and other NATO forces, as well as Arab troops, would have to remain in Syria until a reasonable level of stability, security, and intersectarian trust was achieved. Amazing, saying that after what we've seen in Iraq. Well, he goes on, is such a plan so unthinkable, he asks? And this is where he gets uglier. In recent years, he complains, the mere mention of U.S. ground troops has been enough to stop any conversation. Americans, or at least the intelligentsia and political class, remain traumatized by Iraq, and all calculations about what to do in Syria have been driven by that trauma, end quote. I must interject here that Clinton advisor Robert Kagan seems to have totally forgotten that the millions of Iraqis still driven by that trauma and the hundreds of thousands of American veterans of Kagan's war who are suffering from the effects of that trauma and committing suicide as a result of it every day. That he can actually write that tripe and get it published in the Wall Street Journal without creating a national scandal is a telling comment on the sorry state of American society. There's more of Kagan. Mr. Obama's advisors, he writes, have been reluctant to present him with options that include even smaller numbers of ground forces, assuming that he would reject them. And Mr. Obama has in turn rejected his advisors' quote, less ambitious proposals on the reasonable grounds that they would be probably insufficient. This dynamic, he writes, has kept the president sneering. Yes, that's right, he writes, sneering at those who have wanted to do more but have been reluctant to be honest about how much more. But it has also allowed him to be comfortable settling for minimal pressure-relieving approaches that he must know cannot succeed, but which at least have the virtue of avoiding the much larger commitment that he has so far refused to make. Whatever one may think of Obama, to describe him as being comfortable with the situation in Syria is mind-blowing, as is Kagan's suggestion that, quote, he may be the first president since the end of World War II who simply doesn't care what happens in Europe. If so, it is again a great irony for Europe, and perhaps a tragic one, he notes, while revealing his contempt for allies across the Atlantic. Quote, he says, having excoriated the U.S. for invading Iraq, he tells us, Europeans play no small part in bringing on the crisis of confidence and conscience that today prevents Americans from doing what may be necessary to meet the Middle Eastern crisis that has Europe reeling, end quote. So now it's all the fault of the Europeans. Again, those were the words of PNAC co-founder Robert Kagan, a fellow of the Brookings Institution, foreign policy advisor to Hillary Clinton, husband of Victoria Nuland, Clinton's former press spokeswoman, and currently Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia, who is active behind the scenes during the Ukrainian coup. Given that Robert's brother Frederick was credited with planning the surge in Iraq, remember that? Well, you have to say they're quite a family. Speaking at the Council of Foreign Relations Friday, the same day as Kagan's op-ed appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Clinton was already demonstrating his influence. In September, she said, I laid out a comprehensive plan to counter Iranian influence across the region and its support for terrorist proxies such as Hezbollah and Hamas. We cannot view Iran and ISIS as separate challenges. Regional politics are too interwoven. Raising the confidence of our Arab partners, says Clinton, and raising the cost to Iran for bad behavior will contribute to a more effective fight against ISIS. And as we work out a broader regional approach, she says, we should, of course, be closely consulting with, envelope please, with Israel, our strongest ally in the Middle East. That's Hillary Clinton, and she's no less frightening to me than Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz. She has the gall to lump ISIS with Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah, which has been fighting ISIS, while like her mentor Kagan and her principal funder, Israeli media mogul Haim Saban, Clinton plays Israel's tune, ignoring the support that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey have provided for ISIS while portraying them as U.S. allies. Even Time magazine knows better. Albeit buried deep in an article in its December 7th issue, its writer David Von Drell pointed out that, quote, the Petro Kingdom has for decades funded the spread of the Wahhabi strain of Islam that underlines violent Sunni jihad, whether Al-Qaeda's brand or ISIS. Oil-addicted U.S. presidents, he writes, have long chosen to ignore this issue, but now Obama must start, quote, dialing up the pressure on the oil sheiks to douse the fire of religious zealotry that they have stoked around the world for years, end quote. That's in the December 7th issue of Time, and a subject I'll be exploring at 20 minutes past the hour with my guest, Rania Masri. Turkey presents a different problem, being that it is a member of NATO, which is President Recep Erdogan no doubt considered when he had one of his U.S.-provided F-16s shoot down a Russian fighter yesterday over what he claimed was Turkish territory. Should Russia respond in kind and attack Turkey in any way, Erdogan can call upon his fellow members of NATO to come to his aid, including the U.S., and then we might have an all-out war. Turkey has contributed nothing to the war on ISIS. On the contrary, it has allowed Sunni fighters from all across the Middle East, North Africa, and Chechnya to come across its borders to join ISIS and other jihadist groups that have been trying to oust the al-Assad government. Also, it seems clear that Turkey has facilitated ISIS's sales of Syrian oil that it has used to finance its military actions in both Syria and Iraq. Moreover, it has used F-16s provided by Washington, intended for the bombing of ISIS, to attack Kurdish forces in Iraq. None of what I have said about the Saudis or Turkey is a secret, and Robert Kagan and the neocons who used to criticize the oil sheikdoms know it as well, as I am sure it is Hillary Clinton. What has rendered them silent is both their animosity to the Assad regime and their realization that their favorite country and its leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, is now in bed with the Saudis. If Obama is lacking courage about anything, it's not publicly calling out the Saudis and the Turks, as well as Qatar, for their role in promoting what the media pundits, who also don't talk about it, refer to as Islamic terrorism. Before he arrived in Washington to meet President Obama, French President Francois Hollande was pushing for a grand coalition to defeat ISIS and the U.S. and Russia to join forces in a united fight. Russian President Vladimir Putin welcomed Hollande's proposal, saying that such an alliance is what Moscow had been advocating for months. Putin even ordered his naval forces to begin liaising with the French aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle to coordinate aerial bombing operations in Syria against ISIS. Well, it was apparent from listening to the presentations by Obama and Hollande after their meeting yesterday that such an alliance was no longer on Hollande's agenda. He is due to meet with Putin in Moscow tomorrow, so it will be interesting to see what he has to say there. A different approach to ISIS comes from Israel, which has been providing hospital care to jihadist fighters wounded on the Golan front. Speaking on Israeli radio, Shabti Shabbat, a former chief of Mossad, said the international coalition fighting ISIS must, quote, stop talking and start doing. Right? With this enemy, he said, we have to push aside arguments on law, morality, and comparisons of security and the rights of the individual. That means to do what they did in World War II to Dresden. They wiped it off the map. That is what has to be done to all the territorial enclaves that ISIS is holding, end quote. Unmentioned within thousands of deaths of civilians in Dresden, that it was not a military target, and that Israel has not lifted a finger to fight ISIS. Well, briefly, Haaretz reports that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is demanding, yes, demanding, that the U.S. administration accept construction in the large settlement blocks in the West Bank in return for a yet-to-be-announced package of measures that Israel would implement in the West Bank. That's on top of the $50 billion in arms he is demanding over a 10-year period. Well, at the same time, his cabinet has approved five new Jewish settlements in the largely Bedouin Negev, two of them to be built on top of what are currently Bedouin villages. Netanyahu and other Israeli officials are upset with the decision by the European Union last week to require that consumer products from West Bank Jewish settlements carry labels noting their origin in the Israeli settlements rather than made in Israel. They're also complaining that the world hasn't shown the same sympathy for the handful of Israelis killed by Palestinians as they have for those killed in the attacks in Paris, with Netanyahu actually saying, "We are not to blame for the terrorism directed against us, just as the French aren't to blame for the terrorism against them." Regarding what's happening in Israel, I say, oh yeah? Well, finally, Netanyahu, his fellow Israelis, and the leaders of the American Jewish community welcomed the release from prison last week of convicted Jewish American spy Jonathan Pollard, who had served 30 years in prison for abusing his position as a U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer to provide Israel with what Eitan Haber, a former intelligence advisor Yitzhak Rabin, described as, quote, insane amounts of first-class high-quality information, end quote. Referring to arguments that Pollard spying on an ally was not such a great crime and that the U.S. should have provided the information to Israel anyway, Haber commented, "Friendly espionage? Our claim that Pollard spied for a friendly state and ally is ridiculous and absurd. For any intelligence service anywhere in the world, the exposure of any intelligence information means that the information is lost as if it were published at the start of every news edition." This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine. طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح
طفلة. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we are going to be taking a look at the Jewish lobby and its manifestations at the local and national level. It was felt locally this week as the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority decided it would no longer accept advertisements about political or social issues following an outcry over a pro-Palestinian ad in the Davis Square Red Line T-stop. The ad, sponsored by the Palestine Advocacy Project, projects the word violence over the picture of a small girl with pigtails. The ad states that since September 2000, Israel's military has killed one Palestinian child every 3 days, and ends with the words, "Stop U.S. military aid to Israel." The vote banning such ads was taken at a board meeting of the MBTA and was attended by a large vocal representation from the organized Jewish community on one side and representatives of the Palestine Advocacy Project on the other. ACLU, which has represented the Palestine Advocacy Project's right to display the ad, testified that the First Amendment protects this type of public advocacy. And in fact, its earlier lawsuit had forced the MBTA to display the ad based on their current policy. That policy is now changed, and it remains to be seen whether the new policy will withstand First Amendment scrutiny in the courts. It is clear that the power of the Jewish lobby was on full display here, and although the ad was based on a verifiable fact, screams of anti-Semitism and hate speech fill the air. We will continue to cover this story as it moves forward to a probable new round of litigation by the ACLU. As part of their larger lobbying strategy, Jewish organizations such as the Jewish Community Relations Council has sponsored all expense-paid trips to Israel for community, religious, and political leaders for years and years, including local, state, and federal legislative representatives. Now, 10 Massachusetts state senators are due to leave for Israel on December 3rd on this all-expenses-paid junket. But this time, there is public pushback. Here are excerpts of an article published this week in Mondo Weiss, written by Nancy Murray, a member of the Boston Alliance for Water Justice, who recently led a group tour through the West Bank for the Interfaith Peace Builders. This article outlines the pushback strategy. Here is her rendering of events. All expenses paid junkets to Israel organized for elected officials and community leaders by a lobbying group, the Jewish Community Relations Council, JCRC, of Greater Boston, have generally attracted little public comment. But this is changing. On October 29th, Boston Globe staff reporter Frank Phillips raised the ethical issue of a trip being planned by the JCRC for a quarter of the Massachusetts Senate, even as the Senate was voting to pass a JCRC-sponsored resolution that opposed any actions, campaigns, or movements that would in any way undermine, punish, or otherwise limit, isolate, or diminish any relations with Israel. And no sooner had the news of the trip been made public than members of the Boston Alliance for Water Justice got busy calling the offices of the 10 senators who are due to travel to Israel in early December. They pointed out the conflict of interest and asked the lawmakers to reconsider their participation in a delegation designed to present Israel in a positive light and mute international condemnation of its treatment of Palestinians. For nearly 2 years, the Boston Alliance has campaigned against the Innovative Water Partnership that the Patrick administration had formed with Israel, arguing that the Commonwealth should not be complicit in Israel's use of water as a weapon against the Palestinian people. Last month, they were encouraged to learn that the Water Partnership had been placed on hold for the foreseeable future. But with senators expressing an interest in knowing more about Israel's water technology and hoping to forge stronger business and economic ties, joint water projects could again be on the agenda. Israel's discriminatory water policies may have brought the 8 organizations that currently constitute the Boston Alliance for Water Justice together, but their larger concerns are with Israel's nearly 50-year-long military occupation and the shoot-to-kill impunity and massive human rights abuses being used to sustain it. They want Massachusetts lawmakers to reject economic collaboration with Israel until it complies with international law by ending its occupation and its dispossession and oppression of Palestinians. Boston Alliance member groups summarize their concern in 10 Reasons Why Senators Should Not Go on This Trip, a document that accompanies a petition signed by 1,200 Massachusetts residents. The petition reads, "Massachusetts State Senators, Don't Go to Israel." And it is addressed to State Senate President Stan Rosenberg and State Senators Ben Downing, Ann Gobey, John Keenan, Barbara Letalian, Karen Spilka, Michael Barrett, Eileen Donahue, Richard Ross, and Dan Wolf. We, Massachusetts voters, are dismayed that you intend to go to Israel on a junket to foster closer economic and cultural ties between the Commonwealth and Israel. While the Israeli government continues to implement increasingly draconian violations of international law and human rights against Palestinians, your trip would serve as an endorsement of Israeli policies. Until Israel abides by international law, we encourage you to oppose the use of Massachusetts taxpayer dollars to fund collaborations with the State of Israel. Fresh eyewitness testimony about Israel's repressive policies and practices that the senators are unlikely to encounter on a JCRC junket was provided at the press conference and detailed in an open letter to the senators. The letter was signed by 7 Massachusetts residents who had just a week before returned from being a part of an interfaith peace builders delegation to Israel-Palestine. Following the press conference, this document and copies of the petition were delivered to the offices of each senator as well as the governor, who has expressed an interest in traveling to Israel at some point. That was an excerpt from an article written by Nancy Murray in Mondo Weiss. While there is hope that the senators will not go on the trip to Israel, the senators are being sent the names of Palestinians they might like to speak to if they go. They are also being encouraged to go into the West Bank to see the conditions on the other side of the wall. And now a look at the inside of the Jewish lobby by a man well qualified to do so. M.J. Rosenberg is a journalist who has worked for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, and as a congressional staffer on Capitol Hill. Here he is speaking at a conference sponsored by the Massachusetts Peace Action's Palestine Working Group. The presentation begins with his introduction.
Speaker M.J. Rosenberg is another longtime observer and trenchant analyst of U.S. policy towards Israel-Palestine. As I'm sure most of you know, Rosenberg brings the perspective, the unique perspective of an insider to the activities of the Israel lobby, whom he originally worked for and whose activities he later came to deplore. During the 1980s, Rosenberg served as editor of the Near East Report, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. This was followed by 15 years on the Hill as an aide to various Democratic members of Congress, where he acquired invaluable firsthand experience of how actually APAC works on Congress to shape U.S. policy on the Middle East. This firsthand experience is reflected in the many highly critical columns he wrote for Media Matters during 2009 to 2012, which many of us eagerly awaited for his insights about just what APAC was up to at any particular moment in time. When Media Matters, a progressive news center, turned out to be progressive except for Palestine, Rosenberg resigned.
I was fired, but then I resigned.
Well, that's interesting. Oh, yeah. I didn't want to use that word, and yeah. It was absolutely...
Oh, I was, yeah.
No doubt that there was a lot of pressure. Absolutely. His columns can now be read in The Nation magazine and Huffington Post. M.J. Rosenberg.
Oh, thank you. Thank you all for being here. Politics is my life, so I like to, you know, see people involved with it. It's so important. You know, we always hear it, but I was thinking yesterday, and I know, don't yell at me if this seems like an exaggeration and I'm like a far-out crazy person, but in my opinion, what happened in Paris and what's happened in all these other places around the world with terrorism, a large part of it lays at the fact that the 2000 presidential election in the United States was stolen. This is all George Bush, Iraq War, neocons, all these people. It's not, these things just don't happen. And so I just think it's always, you know, I think my cause this year is going to be, if anyone tells me that they're not voting in the November 2000 election because their favorite candidate didn't get nominated, I'm strangling that person. I mean, really, it is just so important, except not important for any of you because you can vote for whoever you want because you live in Massachusetts. But, you know, it's still important. We in Maryland, my home state, we always say we can vote for whoever we want. And last time we didn't like the Democratic nominee. None of us could stand the Democratic nominee. So a lot of us didn't vote for him. We have a Republican governor. So, you know, it does matter. I want to say something. This is a prelude to my optimistic main thing. I want to talk about the Jews a little bit, of which I am not proudly one. Proudly is stupid to anything I didn't choose. So I'm like, oh, I'm proud. I'm a proud male. Okay. Any movement to change for progressive politics in America has to involve the Jewish community. Every movement in America, every progressive movement, the last time a progressive movement was not heavily, almost to the point of dominated by Jews in this country was William Jennings Bryan in 1896 when they were arguing about bimetallism and silver and whatever that crazy stuff was, when it was the farmers, because Jews were never been big farmers. That wasn't their issue. The Jews, I mean, if you think about labor, the GLBT movement, the women's movement, I mean, the anti-war movement, was there a Vietnam War, for those older people out there like me, was there a Vietnam War demonstration movement? If you took the Jews out, there would have been 10 people standing around. I mean, the women's movement, when you look at the people like Bella Abzug and Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan, and you know, it's just like, but the good news is the Jews are coming back. What they have been is out AWOL on this issue because of that phrase that you're a progressive except for Palestine. That is changing. It's not changing necessarily among our generation, the older people. Sadly enough, the 60s generation has turned out to be a big flop when it comes to the Israel-Palestinian issue. They're as bad as their parents were. But the kids are really different. I mean, and now you see, you know, J Street and Jewish Voice for Peace and the Open Hillel movement, and overarching all that is the fact that it is not cool to be down with Israel for Jewish kids anymore. It is a controversial position to take. And it's like, whereas when I was in school, I mean, and any of you were in school, particularly if you were Jewish, or if you weren't, the default position was pro-Israel. Mm-hmm. It's not anymore. And if you're a it's not. I do a lot of stuff with campuses. I know what goes on campuses. I won't call it pro-Israel. I hate the phrase pro-Israel because they support policies that will lead to the destruction of Israel. So why is that called pro-Israel? If you're supporting Netanyahu, you're supporting the end of the Jewish state. I mean, really? We'll use the term the way they use it. The pro-Israel kids, the AIPAC kids, are on the defensive. Which is why a movement like BDS, which is not that big a movement and hasn't had these great victories yet, drives them insane. Why are they so hysterical about BDS if BDS isn't accomplishing something? It's obviously accomplishing something. And I think, I mean, to have people like Stuart Eisenstadt, you know, a big shot in the United States government, who, oh my God, he's hysterical about BDS. Hear that. Can I say it in the grounds of Harvard? To hear that pig Alan Dershowitz talking about, I mean, what is, if everything is going in their direction, what the hell are they so afraid of? And they're afraid all the time. I got fired from Media Matters because they were afraid. You know what I did? Well, it was Alan Dershowitz who got me fired, so hey, Alan. I may be retired, but you're senile. what Alan Dershowitz did, he took out an ad in the New York Times, which said, and this is the way AIPAC and their bunch operates. If MJ Rosenberg continues working at Media Matters and continues using the word Israel Firster, which I kind of coined the idea of calling them Israel Firsters, if he stays there, I will not support the Democratic Party. I will not support Democratic now, blah, 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 and neither will any of my friends. And within, I mean, at the time I didn't admit it, but now it's so many years later I can say it, I was fired within a week. I mean, the big donors picked up the phone and made threats. And that is how it works. That is how it's been working in this country for decades. If the Palestinian movement is the civil rights issue of our age, the pro-Israel movement is the McCarthyist issue of our age, in which, you know, which is why it's very hard for candidates to say what they think. I'm appalled by what both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders say about Israel. But on the other hand, I know what they're up against. They're up against money power. 40% of the money that goes to the Democratic Party is bundled by AIPAC. 40%. You can't. Wow. The Republicans have so many sources to get money from. Everyone, every industry in the country will support the Republicans because they're the pro-business party. The Democrats have very few obvious sources. And one of the big ones are the Jews. And they insist, members of Congress and presidential candidates, in believing that the Jews all stand behind Netanyahu. And it's a lie. I worked on Capitol Hill for 20 years. You know how they think up there? If someone named Rosenthal says, Congressman Kennedy, here's $50 because I love you and I support you. When Congressman Kennedy sees the name Rosenthal, he assumes this is money I'm getting because I support Israel. That's a great accomplishment that AIPAC has done when, in fact, according to the American Jewish Committee, which is the definitive poll every 4 years that's done about issues that Jews care about, it's the largest poll, no competition. The number of Jews, the percentage of Jews who in any election vote or give money based on Israel is 4 to 6%. The overwhelming issues are for Jews is equality, civil rights, gay rights, environmental issue, all these other issues. You add the Palestinian component to it as a progressive issue, that's going to be, I mean, yeah, the fact of the matter is a lot of the people who are promoting Palestinian rights on the Hill and in Washington are Jews. We have to change the face of it so that they see, so that they begin to understand, just because you're Jewish, just because you're this, you're not supporting Netanyahu. It's hard for them to understand because they're dense. Most of them. I have to say that. They really are. I mean, I have to. I worked for so many good ones. I worked for Carl Levin, who was absolutely brilliant, but was terrified of the lobby as well. I mean, so you could be depressed about their power, and I was, and then came the Iran vote. I was absolutely sure that Obama was going to lose. Why? Because, amazingly enough, around 10 years ago, AIPAC decided that their number one goal was no longer to maintain the occupation and make life miserable for Palestinians. Their number one goal is a war with Iran. A war with Iran that Israel would start and that the United States would come in right behind. They have been pushing all the sanctions, the sanctions bills, all the punitive stuff on Iran for over 15 years. It's been 15 years they've promoted it, and it all culminated this year on this vote. And Obama said, no, I'm doing this. Kerry said no. And then the Democratic Party lined up, amazingly enough, not behind the Prime Minister of Israel, but behind the President of the United States. And And it was everyone. It was some of the worst members. Steny Hoyer, who is the minority leader of the House, he's apex enforcer. He's not Jewish, so he's perfect. He's their enforcer. If you don't support this, you're going to lose money. He voted with the president. And he would refuse to enforce for them. Cory Booker, this awful senator from New Jersey, who has been involved with AIPAC his entire life, voted against AIPAC on this issue. Overwhelmingly, 90% of the Jewish members of the House and Senate supported Obama and not Netanyahu. Remember when Chuck Schumer made his announcement? Everyone thought, that's it. All the Jewish senators and everything are going to fall into line. You know, no one fell into line except Ben Cardin of Maryland. No one ever heard of him. So, I mean, it's really changing. And for the first time in my life, I feel really good. I don't feel defensive. I think the word defensiveness is really important. Certain issues, you know you're winning when you see who's defensive. Gay rights, for instance. Who's defensive on that issue? I mean, the people who support it or the people who are trying to, you know, who are trying to stop it? African Americans, the whole civil rights movement. Who's defensive? The ones who want the flag or the ones who don't want the flag? Who, you know, it's like, and this, the Palestinian issue has become one now where, and I know lots of Palestinians, and as my life has progressed, I know, sadly or happily, I know many more Palestinians than I know Israelis. It used to be very different. But I know none of the Palestinians I know fear for the future. They're optimistic about the future. They're depressed about what's going on right now, but they're confident about the future. It's the Jewish right. Remember, the Jewish right, not all Jews, the Jewish right that's scared all the time. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? What's going to happen is the occupation is going to end. And as Rami said, this issue is going to be resolved because, amazingly enough, it is one of the easier issues to resolve. We've all have known what the solution is going to be for years and years. It's just that each time we get close, I recommend for anyone, if you haven't read it, read The Truth About Camp David by Clayton Swisher, which explains how the Israelis sabotaged 2000. We were on the brink. You know, you read it. You know, do you know what? I just have to, this one thing drives me insane. That the whole Rabin-Arafat agreement was this, you know, was to be done in these stages and to be this 5-year transition period. And each, and then the Israelis would hand over territory in stages, incrementally, to the Palestinians. And when they got to when the Palestinians controlled 90%, at that point they would go into what Rabin and Arafat called final status negotiations to end the conflict once and for all. Barak, Ehud Barak, who came in as the peace prime minister, he immediately, first thing he did was he dropped the Palestinians completely and decided he would negotiate with Syria. Nobody was demanding to negotiate, but that was what he decided to do. Then when he got to it, he turned to Clinton and said, we have to make the Palestinians show their bad faith early. Let's go to negotiations immediately. Let's not wait till the Palestinians have 90%. Let's do it now. And Clinton went along with it, and the game worked perfectly. Arafat was not able to deliver at that point. The Palestinians had gained basically nothing from the Oslo deal. And Barak got what he wanted, was Intifada II. And nothing good has happened since. As, not to name drop, as President Bill Clinton said to me in 1997, okay, it was to name drop, he said Yigal Amir was the only assassin in history who achieved all his goals. The bullet that killed Arafat, killed the peace process, and killed Rabin, killed the peace, we'll talk about the Arafat part later, killed Rabin, and unless we do something, that same process that, you know, that lost Rabin, that ended Oslo, that gave us Intifada II, what's waiting in the wings, are the terrorists that we are seeing in the streets of Paris. Israel doesn't want to negotiate. They say they can't talk with Hamas. If this continues at the rate things are going, they'll be begging to talk with Hamas. I mean, the point is, the only answer is talking. The only answer is negotiating. But the good news is more and more people are coming around. That's why you are lucky to hear me speak in one of the few optimistic speeches I've ever given. Thank you.
This is to MJ Rosenberg. Two questions. One, AIPAC lost the Iran nuclear deal and lost a lot of support. Is that going to be maintained? And the other is, if we've known for years what the result, what the final resolution of the occupation is, given what's happened on the ground, how do we get there?
Okay, I'm going to punt on part number two and let the others deal with part two. I'm going to let the others deal with part two. Let me just address the issue of part one. AIPAC.
Hold it close. Hold it close.
Did you hear this one? Oh, can you hear this? Okay. I'm going to just address the question about AIPAC and Congress, and is the momentum, the good momentum, going to last? I neglected to mention that in our victory on the Iran vote, they couldn't even get a Senate vote. Do you remember at the end it was kind of like they were desperately fighting, just let's get the Senate to go on record, and Obama said no. And there was no vote. It was just, you know, the president was sustained. The reason it's going to continue is because the illusion of power is everything. And AIPAC lost that illusion. In the old days, which was, it was yesterday, but it could be, they would go after anyone who signed a pro-Palestinian letter. They would go after them by, you know, sending money to the opponents, all that kind of stuff. That's how they operate. That's what their strength is made of. They made a decision. I saw this in the Washington Post. They're not going after the people who voted wrong on Iran. They have decided to give everybody a pass. Well, once they start giving passes on Iran, how much harder is it to not give a pass on, let's say, a Palestine issue like this letter that we're talking about? So I do think that as long as we do our work and intensify our work, I think we've got them on the run now. I think the momentum, they have all the money. I mean, that's really a big thing in politics. But for the first time, they've lost. So that's got to be worth something. And they lost on the issue that is for them a life and death issue and the biggest issue of all. And they lost. So I'm pretty optimistic that we at least can start making some real inroads.
Okay. Pat?
Yes, they lost, but they increased by 50% the aid. And so did they lose?
What do I do about that? Well, they did lose, and they didn't increase by 50% yet. That's still just a discussion thing between, the aid, I don't see any real possibility for the time being of stopping the aid or linking the aid. You know, it's so amazing with aid. Do you know that none of the states get federal money without strings attached? You don't get Department of Education money without agreeing to do all these things. Only Israel gets money with no strings attached. But I think it would be a real uphill battle at this point to go after that, though I'm 100% for it. I think the first job is on more of the humanitarian issues, political rights issues, those kinds of questions with Palestinians. Because if we're seen as going after the aid right away, then they immediately point to, oh, you're anti-Israel. Aid is our lifeline. So I think we have to, but I do think, after all, the fact of the matter is, if you linked aid, you'd pretty much solve the problem, really. But it's that, but that's an uphill struggle.
The woman in white, I can't. Yes, you.
Just a quick follow up on what you just said. That's a point of accuracy. I've always understood that of all the money that we give to Israel, something like 70% has to come back to buy our weapons. So the unholy alliance between our government and our military is that an accurate statement?
Well, it was an accurate statement in the old days when I don't have the mic. You're doing a terrible job. No, I'm kidding. You're doing a great job. Okay, I'll give it back to you, though. Okay. They used to always pride themselves, the Israelis, on the fact that all the money that we gave them in terms of weapons, that it had to be spent here. But a few years ago, they decided they didn't really want to spend it here. They dropped that provision. That they're no longer making those presentations of your money comes back to you in Iowa, your money. No, they decided that wasn't convenient, so they got rid of that too. So I mean, but in general, it's an unholy alliance, because ultimately, who else are you going to? They're not going to be buying these airplanes from the Russians. So they are. So you know, Boeing and McDonnell Douglas and all these things. So it's a really good point. Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to go to the very back. Is that Susan?
Yes.
Yes. So, if you can wait for the mic, though.
Is there a reason why this doesn't work?
Could you guys just share down there?
Oh, yeah, we'll share.
If it works.
Okay.
None of them work?
Or maybe we can use this one.
Great job, all three of you. Really appreciate this. So, there are these universities that have affiliation agreements with universities in Palestine. So Bard College and Dreyfus University had affiliation agreements with Al-Quds University in Abu Dis in the West Bank. So 2 years ago, I did a sabbatical there, and I witnessed the jihad rally on campus that caused Brandeis to cut its ties with Al-Quds. And there was absolutely no evidence whatsoever that these were students at Al-Quds. In fact, I'm almost certain they were not, because I was there. There were people who came in from the outside dressed from head to toe in black, only with eye slits. So there was absolutely no way to identify these people. But nonetheless, it was what appeared to be a jihad rally, and I don't understand enough Arabic to know what they said, but Brandeis cut their ties. And the Boston Globe reported it as a rally that was caused by Al-Quds students. It wasn't. But do you see any change in that kind of direction? I mean, none of us, I don't think any of us here, could really justify a jihad rally, even though we're very pro-Palestine. You know, they were stomping on Israeli flags and everything. It was pretty horrible. But like I said, I'm almost certain they were not Al-Quds students, even though the media was told that they were. What do we do about situations like that?
Are you directing this to one of the speakers?
Any one of you. What do we do about situations like that when we're really staunch advocates of Palestinian rights? This puts us in a real quandary.
I just want to say on that one thing, that the fact that it was Brandeis that even had the program, I'm into the thing of looking at things half full today. Brandeis is a Jewish university, so it's really you or your colleagues or whatever are to be commended that there was such a program. But over and over again, the people who look for every opportunity to taint anything that's Arab or Palestinian or Muslim with terrorism. So I really think there's very little that people can do when you're up against people who are just lying to you. Unless, you know, so. But as far as the actual people, you might know more about.
The Boston Globe reported it as a rally that was started by students. And so I was there, and so I read it online, and I wrote, I'm here right now. I witnessed this. They were not our students. But that didn't make any difference.
Can I say something? I was teaching at Al-Quds Bard College at the time.
Hold on. Are these questions?
I don't know.
Well, you may say something, but it has to be brief.
Okay. This is a tempest in a teapot. There was such a rally. Al-Quds University has free speech for organizations. It has free speech for Hamas, free speech for Fatah, free speech. And every year, every organization has a week or two in which they have demonstrations and flags and the whole business. This particular event was a memorial of when the Mossad assassinated their leader, okay, about 20 years ago, and it was a one-day event. Yes, they dressed in black, and it was no big deal for the students there. It was no big deal for the faculty there. It was not a declared, it was a memorial service and a declaration, you're not going to kill us. You know, we're opposed to your killing us.
Okay.
That's what they were saying.
Clarification appreciated. I'm going to ask preferentially if people have questions they'd like to direct to our other two speakers. Please. Okay.
This is directed to the whole essence of this convivium, that, and I think you brought this out very well, that maybe we should change our focus a little bit and get to the very heart of this without being offensive. If the Jews can be convinced, not only in this country but in the world, that this situation is not good for the Jews, that's the heart of this. And if the Jews can be convinced that through Israel, through other of the actions, they've frittered away the goodwill that they had at the instant of the establishment of Israel. Whether that would have happened without the Holocaust or not, I doubt. And they had the world's goodwill. They've lost it. And by them losing it, all the Jews in this country and all the rest of the Jews in the world are losing it also. And once every Jew understands that the present situation isn't good for the Jews, I think...
Okay, understood. Was that a question to anyone?
It's a question as to whether that emphasis should be tried.
Okay. You're welcome to respond if anybody wants to respond.
I agree. I think that will be very. You have people like the mainstream Jewish organizations and the Israeli government that will take that, what you just said, flip it over and say, you see, we're losing the support of everybody. That's why Israel needs more. I mean, so it's, you know, Israel has adopted. Netanyahu's approach is like no other Israeli leader in that he kind of likes the previous Israeli leaders, well, before Begin anyway, the ones like Ben-Gurion and Rabin and those guys, Golda Meir, they used to say it's a new day, we're strong, the Jews don't have to be afraid of anybody. Netanyahu's approach, which is also one of the reasons they're losing the kids, is it's 1942. And the Holocaust is about to happen. And my answer to that would be, really? If it's 1942, what exactly has Israel accomplished? I mean, it's not 1942. They lie. I want to say, well, I have the microphone. I'm going to hog it for 1 second. I left out a key point I need to say. It has to do with Elizabeth Warren and hassling members of Congress. I worked for them for 20 years. They do not like anyone disagreeing with them. They like to have events in their living rooms or in a meeting where everybody applauds them and tells them how wonderful they were. Any of you saw the YouTube of Bernie Sanders during the Gaza war? He was as nice as could be until the Palestinian supporters started mentioning Gaza, and he lost his game completely. It's important to hassle them, and that means even writing letters to the local paper. I mean the local, whatever the Brookline paper is, or, you know, the Watertown paper, in which you just say, do you know that, you know, I was disappointed that. Mm-hmm. It really drives them crazy. And not to let them get away with being good on the issues that are easy for them. For all these years, you guys, no offense, let Barney Frank get away with being awful on this issue because he's so wonderful on everything else. And now, as a sidelight, it's his sister, Ann Lewis, who's the number one person on the Hillary Clinton campaign, whose job is to keep her on the right side of this issue. Can't do that anymore. You know, Barney, it's easy for you to be a spokesman on gay rights. That's easy. Who in Brookline is going to give you a hard time about that? And the fact of the matter is, what makes you a leader is taking stands on the ones that are hard. And that's why, and you don't ever don't give them a pass on Palestine.
Is Barney Frank in our audience?
That was journalist M.J. Rosenberg speaking at the conference sponsored by Massachusetts Peace Action Palestinian Working Group. One more story before we have to leave. There is a raging controversy in the United States and throughout the world concerning the immigration of Syrian refugees. The tension between security considerations and humanitarian outreach is at the center of the debate. There is immense pressure to relieve the suffering of thousands of men, women, and children literally fleeing for their lives. But Israel seems to be on a different planet. There is no consideration for helping out during this immigration crisis. In fact, they are even denying entry to Palestinians who were born and brought up there, who have been out of the country trying to return. Put this story in juxtaposition with the Syrian crisis. On October 10, 2015, Amin Hussein was denied entry into Palestine while returning to be with family and friends. He was deported by Israel after 15 hours of detention, interrogation, a strip search, and a body cavity search. The official reason given was for the prevention of illegal immigration and public security or public safety or public order considerations. Hussein writes, "I am not the first Palestinian to be denied entry into their homeland, nor will I be the last. But it is clear that Israel has escalated this practice, and we should discover effective ways to fight it."
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
Man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're listening to episode 727 of Unwelcome Guests, The Terrorism Surveillance Complex. I'm Robin Upton, and slightly crowded episode this week. We finish our adaptation of Alan Frankovich's Gladio, that is at the end of the first hour and for the whole of the second hour. But first, we're going to hear a talk from 2014. This is from perhaps the most senior NSA whistleblower you've probably never heard of, Diane Rourke, who was on the House Intelligence Committee for 17 years and in charge of the NSA budget. You might think if she blew the whistle, then people would pay attention. Well, who are these people who are going to take note? People like you and me, yeah, maybe, if we're informed. If we're relying on commercial media, of course, no, it's going to be blacked out. Is it going to be people in the upper echelons, people therefore behoven to the deep state? Well, I don't think so. They're more likely to do what they actually did in her case, launch a complicated system of persecution. But I'll let the woman speak for herself. This is Diane Rourke speaking from 2014.
It's hard to squeeze this in, so I'm going to go pretty fast here. But I am here to tell you that our liberty, yours, mine, the entire country's, is at great risk, more than ever since the Civil War, I would say. Our republic is at risk because of this pervasive surveillance. It covers an unbelievable amount of your life, and there is no way to escape it, unfortunately. We are information that we would not give to our neighbors, perhaps even to our extended family. The government has all of that. They have an enormous amount of information on all of this. And this started with 9/11 and is justified by counterterrorism, but has been totally ineffective for counterterrorism. Why? Because there is so much data that they can't make any sense out of it. That's why. Further, the government has begun lying and misleading. They have deliberately kept this out of the courts as much as they could. It's now beginning to get there. They've lied to the Supreme Court twice. What would you call this? I would call it corruption. I would say this excessive power has already corrupted our republic and our government. And it's time that we take it back. So I'll just fill you in a little bit. Jeff gave you a lot on me. My education, I went to Catholic University for a BA and an MA in international relations. Subsequently, I went to the University of Florida for most of the PhD work. And then I was employed by the federal government. Unfortunately, in international relations, there aren't a lot of other choices. And I was first at the Energy Department, the international section of the Energy Department, where I warned that the Europeans should not sign up for Soviet gas and looked at alternatives. Then I went to the Defense Department, to the Pentagon. Subsequently, I went to the White House National Security Council staff, where I was in the intelligence section and worked primarily on counterintelligence and also on Soviet violations of the arms control treaties. After that, I went to the House Intelligence Committee, where I stayed for 17 years. In the last 5 of those years, I had the NSA account, which means that I supervised, myself and the Democratic staff were on this, were the primary people on the House side to make sure that NSA was doing things legally, that it was doing things effectively in a financially good manner. That they were not skipping things, they were not leaving us at risk, and I would make recommendations for changes to their budget every year. So that's basically my background. What happened was that only a couple of months before I retired in 2002, I found out about this secret program that I was not supposed to know about. And I got a number of sources eventually told me about it. And let me tell you, no matter what they say today, I was told it was not just metadata, it was content. It was dragnet content domestically. Furthermore, they had just then started, by July of 2002, they had started collecting in other information, non-communications information on Americans and databasing it. So I'm just going to go down a very quick list of some of the things, this is not exhaustive, but some of the things of yours that they are collecting. Land phones, your cell phones, your emails, your texts, your Skype, your chats, your webcams, your social media postings, the FBI loves them. Postal mail, a huge program on the postal mails. business records other than communications. The Patriot Act is so broadly worded that they can go to any business and get any record and put a gag order on the owner. So he can't tell you that your records have been seized. Government records have been amassed, which was forbidden under the Privacy Act, but apparently there is a national security exception to that now. So all local and state and federal government records can be amalgamated in a federal database. That alone gives them an enormous amount of information about you, including gun licenses, of course. But if you think about it, what is there in this country that is a transaction of some sort that is not personal, that is not government or business? They have basically every transaction that you ever make. Remote activation. Jeff covered that. So if they become interested enough in you to make you a target, they can remotely activate your cell phone and turn it into a microphone so they can listen to what your meeting is about. They can locate your cell phone, and sometimes they do this as for everything in one cell phone area to try and narrow it down to who they're looking for, so they're collecting en masse at a tower. And another one that just came out just recently is facial recognition. Both the NSA and FBI are big into facial recognition now. They're collecting photos everywhere. The FBI hopes to have 52 million photos by the end of 2015. NSA is collecting them massively also through electronic communications. And that means emails, texts, social media, video conference, driver's licenses, passports, visas, private webcam, videos including a large amount of sexual pornography. There is no subject and no means too intrusive for them. There is no content that is off limits. Their motto is collect it all, as shown in the Snowden documents. And what they told me before I left was, we're going to own the web. And they do. The Snowden documents have revealed it. They do own the web. As Glenn Greenwald, the primary reporter for the Snowden documents, said, there is no place to hide. There is basically almost nothing you can do except for not use electronics, use cash all the time. That might get you in trouble with the IRS. And basically live a life of 50 years ago, which would make you very inefficient. Now, the administration has argued not to worry, not to worry. There are a lot of protections, and you know, you're just fine unless you're doing something wrong. And that's not true at all. First of all, the effective protections were removed. One of the arguments I used when I went around and talked to a lot of people was, this is bad, this is unconstitutional, but at least restore the civil liberties protections that were there to begin with, that they deactivated. And I knew the technology because I had persuaded Congress to pay for it, that it was supposed to be directed against foreign intelligence. And they still have not been restored, and that was automated tracking so that nobody can pull your file off the servers and not have somebody know about it. And the other one was encryption of domestic identities until there is a warrant, an individual warrant, in hand. Those were two extremely effective ways to protect privacy if necessary, and they still are not in place. So the primary user of much of this data, given that it's domestic surveillance, the primary user is the FBI, not NSA. And what we don't know, nobody ever focuses on, is that copies of these databases, of the NSA databases, go to both the FBI and the CIA. Has anybody, to your knowledge, ever asked about controls and accesses to those databases? No. There's not a peep about it. And that's where the trouble really is. Apparently, CIA controls through them for any reason whatsoever, and the FBI assures us that everything is fine there. So what other checks and balances do we have? Congress. Congress is an abomination on this issue, an absolute abomination. The intelligence committees have been given a lead by the leadership, and the leadership is four square behind the administration on this, and they appoint the intelligence committee members. We need new leadership. And then they insist that the only legislation in the House Senate will consider is legislation from the intelligence committees, which means nothing significant ever happens, including this last bill, which apparently raised more backdoor holes than it solved. What's the other? They also say, oh, you can depend on the courts, the FIS, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. They are watching us like a hawk. Well, the fact of the matter is, the FISC cannot deny a warrant. They have not been able to do so since 2008 in a legislation that was passed by Congress. So they cannot deny a warrant. They also give group warrants, not individual warrants, which means, for instance, let's take hypothetically a whole area code. If NSA wants to search an entire area code, it can do that. If the FISC approves of it, and they basically approve of it. They also, and most people don't know this, have jurisdiction over only a very small part of the collection that is being done. Why is that? Most of the collection is not done under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act or the Patriot Act. And it is done under executive order, under presidential wartime powers. So this order is called EO-12333, and they are taking a provision that used to appear innocuous and reinterpreting it, as they have reinterpreted everything else, to allow them to do basically anything they want. The FISC initially also, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, also initially said that they were unable to stop them because they did not have constitutional powers. They did not have the power to rule on the constitutionality of different things. Colleen Kolar-Kotelly was the head judge on that court, and she approved this and didn't tell the other judges for quite a number of years. I asked to see her, to tell her that there were privacy protections that could be put on it and that she should insist upon doing, and she refused to see me. So did Judge Rehnquist of the Supreme Court. So that's the judicial branch. There's no hope there either. Well, there is potentially, but it's going to be years down the road because the Supreme Court has said that they want it to go through all the lower court and appeals courts, and they're only looking at one small part of the program at a time, and this is a massive, massive program. These tactics, I hate to tell you, also trickle down to local law enforcement who deal with the FBI and who start doing some of the same things they have done, such as sneak and peek searches, which I was subjected to and which they have never admitted. These are supposedly illegal under the law. You have to be notified within 7 days normally, unless you get an extension. They're apparently happening everywhere across the United States by local law enforcement as well as the FBI. And finally, the NSA data is now being used for criminal investigations, not just for counterterrorism, which was the original purpose. The original purpose of counterterrorism was why to include other foreign intelligence targets as well, But what is not acknowledged, but was well documented in a Reuters article, is that it started being, they started giving tips to local law enforcement. And as usual, it starts with drug enforcement. So especially international drug couriers and so on. So this is another corruption, because the courts themselves have become corrupted because they create a fake evidentiary trail, not admitting that they found this under the NSA surveillance program, because if they did, the judge would be able to rule on the constitutionality of it. So everything, in my view, is becoming corrupted. Another thing, is it effective against terrorism? Some people are willing to say the end justifies the means. That if it's cutting these terrorists down, that's fine. We'll take it. But it has been known since July of 2009 that it has been completely ineffective against domestic terrorism. That was the date on which the unclassified summary of a study by the five inspectors general of the intelligence community, what that was requested by Congress, but it apparently didn't read it. That was when it said specifically, we went and asked all the all-source analysts if any of this material had been critical to any counterterrorism case since it began in October of 2001. And they said no. And since then, Judge Dick Leon has said the same thing, and the president's own panel that he appointed said the same thing. There is one judge that that went along with the government and everything that disagreed, but it's clear it's not helping. And one of the reasons it's not helping is because they are drowning in their excessive data. They can't make sense of it. They can't automatically target and get targets to the analysts to look at. So it is completely ineffective. And just to give you a little more information on what they did to me, I argued with a lot of these people when I went to them, and I went to members of, to Nancy Pelosi and to Porter Goss on my own committee. I wrote them numerous memos over a 3-month period and kept them up with what was happening with evolving events, and kept trying to persuade them to do something about it, because they were among the gang of four who had been briefed on it. Nothing was ever done. Of course, nothing has been done since then. When I found out about the program, shortly afterwards, I talked to a senior, former NSA senior official, and who was trying to improve relations between Congress and the NSA, and came to see me. And I told him what I had heard. And I said, if this is true, I am going to fry them. You know what happened? They fried me instead. And they fried four of my friends as well. What happened was, When I had talked to everybody, and I talked to a lot of people in the executive branch, David Addington, Cheney's lawyer who basically ran the program, refused to meet with me. But I talked to other people. I talked to General Hayden, who was heading the NSA at that time, twice about it. I talked to the deputy director of National Intelligence for Collection. Everybody would listen, but they wouldn't say much, except for General Hayden, who gave me some valuable information that made me even more concerned. And everyone I talked to, every single one, agreed that it was going to leak. And as I said, because it is so obviously illegal. It is so obviously contrary to all the training that intelligence people have had about what they can and cannot do. And they all agreed. Well, I was really amazed it didn't leak for 4 years until December of 05. And at that time, I opened up the paper, and I said, there was a headline across the front of it, and I said, wow, it finally came out. They immediately started an investigation with 20 FBI agents and 5 U.S. prosecutors. So it was a big full court press, and the White House was determined that the culprit would be found because very few people had been briefed into this program. So they were very hopeful that it could be, the leaker could be found this time. Finally, in August of 06, they called me, the House General Counsel called me and said the FBI would like to know if you would voluntarily cooperate with their leak investigation. And I said, yes, I will cooperate, but I will not tell them my sources. So finally, in February of 2007, I went for a little meeting with them. It turned into an interrogation. And it turns out I was one of their prime suspects because I had so vocally opposed it. I thought at the end of our 3-hour talk that they were mollified. They were actually friendly at the end. And so we thought it was all over. My lawyer put it in her dead letter case. And then in late July of 2007, they raided me at 6 o'clock in the morning. We went through my entire house, every drawer, every closet, every mattress, everything, every book, and hauled away cartons and cartons of stuff and my computer and my printer, everything they could find. However, I was never indicted. It turns out four of my friends were also raided, 3 of them at the same time that I was. And the fourth one, Tom Drake, was raided in November of that year. You may have seen some of them on TV. Bill Binney is the one who developed part of the system that they incorporated into this domestic surveillance, which they could not have done without it. And so he has been talking a considerable amount, despite the fact that he has 4 amputations of his legs. And he is going around, making the rounds, going to Europe, doing everything he can to oppose this. So too is his sidekick, Kirk Weedy. He's another one. And then Ed Loomis, who helped Bill develop the system, a larger system of which they used only one part. And finally, Tom Drake. Tom Drake was indicted. My attorney was told that they were going to indict Tom and me, or one of us. And they were trying to get a conspiracy charge against all of us, but they finally dropped that. Anyway, in the end, they raided me. They refused to tell me the status of my case. In Tom's case, what happened was they dropped all 10 felony charges for 35 years in prison under the Espionage Act. The reason they used that is not because it was meant to be used against leakers or whistleblowers. It's because it has the most draconian sentences. So they used that. And 4 days before the trial, the public trial, they had already gone through hearings dealing with classified information. 4 days before the public trial, they dropped all charges. Why? Because they had set him up. It was fraudulent. With both him and me, they couldn't find anything that we had done that they could charge us with. So they made up the charges. In my case, they came in December of 2009, long 2.5 years after my interview with them. And they called my attorney and asked me to plead guilty to felony perjury at the interview. And they read a quote to her. She called me and read it to me. And I said, well, you know, I remember that. Exactly. That sounds like just about an exact quote, but it was a different subject. And of course, they had covered up the top and the bottom of their notes so that she couldn't see the subject. And they were hoping we would not remember. And with Tom, what they did when they raided him, they allegedly found 5 documents that were not marked as classified, took them to NSA, which obligingly, retroactively classified them. And then tried to, those were the main 5 charges against him, and then they built on those and said that he had obstructed justice by trying to delete some things from his computer, normal deletions. Anyway, that is the story. Tom is now very, very active also on the speaking circuit. So Tom Drake and Bill Binney, when you see them. There was also a Frontline piece on May 13th, which is still available online, that is 2 hours, but basically gives you the whole storyline, puts it in context for people who can't follow it themselves. So what is my message to you from my story? My message to you is that there is no one who is untouchable. I thought I was protected by legislative privilege, by separation of powers. I thought they would never dare to try and string up a congressional staffer who had been in charge of their budget and oversight. Well, it didn't bother him at all. It didn't bother him at all. All of us are vulnerable, especially those who are leading opinion leaders and dissidents on policy of any kind. You may have seen that DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, regards anti-abortionists as potential terrorists, former military as potential terrorists, gun owners as potential terrorists.
I hope I'm on the list. I better be. If you're not on the list, you're not doing enough.
Indeed, I often wonder the absence of congressional opposition to this and other opposition and the failure of reporters to take this up. I'm wondering what they have on them. You know? I'm just wondering if in key times they don't pull something out.
And the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court,
yes,
justices.
And the Supreme Court.
Like the one that approved Obamacare.
But I want you to know, when you click that I agree button online, you're giving away your privacy. It's commercial tracking is equally bad. But the big difference, what's the big difference? When people say, well, they all track you. Who cares? You know, the government tracks you too. The government has enormous power and control over you. Enormous. They can string you up for something if they look far enough. There are so many regulations. They can stick the IRS on you, Jeff knows. They can do dirty tricks. They can do so much against you. And it's just, and at the very minimum, what you're going to find is that the only news you will hear eventually is what the government wants you to hear. That's what's going to happen. So in conclusion, I contend that government and business spying both is rampant and is totally out of control. And we need to focus on this at both the state and national levels. Terrorism is never going to conquer the United States. We have to get this in perspective. It will never bring us to our knees. But this will bring us to our knees. It will destroy our republic. It will destroy our liberty. Unless we act, it will only worsen. Because data mining and data collection is going to become ever more effective. They will not willingly give it up, as you have seen. In fact, there was a court case in which another gentleman was sent to jail for resisting NSA, partly. They tried to find something on him, and they might have framed him, too. But anyway, it was the head of Quest Communications. And he did go to jail. He is now out, and he's writing a book. But in his submission, he revealed He was not allowed to use the NSA defense at court. That's another thing. They pulled state secrets, so he could not use that as his defense. But he was approached 6 months before 9/11 to give NSA access to his telecommunications fiber optic lines. He consulted his general counsel, and the general counsel said it was unconstitutional, so he told them no, and he ended up in prison. This is a grassroots, bipartisan issue. There is no politician you can trust with this kind of power, not Republican or Democrat, as has been well shown. We need to get active on this. We need to make sure that every single person who is nominated for or runs for national office must declare himself on this issue so the voters know where he stands. Finally, the last closing thought is that I want you to know that Glenn Greenwald, the primary reporter on the Snowden documents, has been saying for some time that he has saved the worst. By far the worst was yet to come. I was hoping that he found the extremely compartmented intelligence programs that revealed who they were targeting. And we were told by a fellow named Russell Tice that they were tracking it specifically all the elites, basically. You know, it was all three branches. It was Congress and congressional staff. It was judges, attorneys, international firms. It was their own executive branch people, I guess, to see if they were towing a line, not leaking. People at the White House and the State Department, they're actually going after their own people. And by the way, Jim Risen, who broke the story originally, said when General Petraeus was found by his emails, by the way, by the emails database that the FBI had, this whole story came out. When General Petraeus was kicked out of the CIA as head of CIA because of the affair he was having, Jim Risen said to me, the surveillance state has started eating its own. This is an example of what can happen. And so for over 12 years now, this program has become embedded in concrete, practically. It is going to be an enormous fight to get this out of here. But in the meantime, they have electronic files. They've lied and said they don't have files. It's automatically filed in the database under your telephone number, your computer IP address, your email address. It's all filed automatically when it comes in. For 12 years, they've been collecting files on you.
On the radio today, on Lars Larson's show, a successful businessman called up to report that his six banking accounts had all been shut down. Because one of them was an account he had money in for his gun collecting activity and stuff. The others were his multiple business accounts, his college fund accounts and whatnot. And he was told by Bank of America, Umpqua Bank, that they were complying with a request from the Department of Justice to cease business with people who are engaging in transactions with guns and ammunition. And so when you brought that up here, I'm listening to you tonight and thinking, well, how would the banks know whose accounts to look at if the NSA and surveillance weren't telling them? And so would you suspect that it was the Department of Justice, NSA, informing Umpqua Bank that this person has this, will you help us or shut them down?
I don't know that it would be. This was federal government policy, you heard?
Yeah, they're doing it. It's a volunteer thing. They're asking them, all the major banks, to voluntarily cease business with account holders who are involved in guns and ammunition transactions.
As I said, some of this is incredibly intrusive. Some of the things that have been mentioned under the business records provision, other than communications, include things like your credit rating, your credit transactions, your banking transactions. So, if that's the case, certainly.
Now, there is more to the question and answer session than that. I stopped it there because I wanted to get the rest of Alan Frankovich's Gladio and finish it in this episode. We're going to continue almost where we left off. I'm just going to repeat for context one remark by the principal commentator and convicted bomber, Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
When the Peteno attack occurred, in spite of it being an attack against the Carabinieri, where three Carabinieri died, they decided it was more convenient for them to cover it up than to act against the person responsible. The motive was, above all, political. And even today, they hide behind the excuse of national security.
There's a TV announcement which is slightly similar to what we heard about Olof Palme's murder. So they really don't know. They're following all leads and they've already excluded a political motive.
Investigators are following all leads. 200 people are being questioned. The voice of the telephone call is being heard by thousands. No one recognizes it. This morning, news of the arrests. The accused are all, apart from the youngest, ex-convicts, thugs linked to the world of prostitution. Any political motive is excluded. The hypothesis, a personal vendetta against the Carabinieri.
There's archive footage of General Mingarelli, commander of the Udine Carabinieri.
Today, the commander of Udine got the announcement of the arrest. We have arrested six people in a combined operation using special forces from Gorizia, Udine, and Verona.
Judge Felice Casson.
General Mingarelli was commander of Udine Carabinieri. It might seem strange that the commander of Carabinieri was party to the cover-up of an attack where three of his men died.
Libero Gualtieri, head of the Italian parliamentary inquiry into Gladio.
Nella strage di Peteano,
Mingarelli did divert the Peteano investigation. He was convicted for this, as were other officials.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
General Mingarelli undoubtedly knew the existence of Claudio. He knew of the structure running parallel to that of the armed forces and which was running in his jurisdiction, being head of the Carabinieri in the Udine region. He is a key person. This whole thing started with him, even if he only gave the orders. Mingarelli was convicted for crimes related to the cover-up of Peteno.
Judge Felice Casson.
Mingarelli è stato condannato per reati connessi.
At first, he received a sentence of 10 years and 6 months.
Primo grado a 10 anni e 6 mesi di reclusione, che poi sono stati abbassati.
Later reduced to 2.5 years.
Questa è la sentenza tuttora pendente.
A sentence he is now serving.
On December the 7th, 1970, Prince Valerio Borghese organized neo-fascists in an attempt to overthrow the Italian government. The Italian Ministry of the Interior was to be captured. But after units had moved into position, a telephone call cancelled the entire operation. In the aftermath of the aborted coup, the existence of the parallel structures of Gladio was uncovered.
Lieutenant Colonel Amos Spiazzi.
Il giorno del golpe borghese, precisamente la sera dell'8 dicembre del 1970, ricevuto l'ordine di fare una esercitazione di ordine pubblico. Quindi di uscire.
The day of the Borghese coup, on the evening of December 8, 1970.
Sì, cosa significa di sicuro affidamento?
I received an order to carry out an exercise in the maintenance of public order using reliable men.
Ed andare a presidiare determinati punti.
What did reliable mean? Men who were neither left nor right wing extremists. We were to guard certain predetermined locations which could be vulnerable in an uprising.
Attivare esigenza triangolo voleva dire,
a message told me to activate plan triangle.
Andare a raggiungere quei punti che ciascuna unità dell'esercito going to those predetermined points together with units of selected men, appunto, delle sommosse,
in order to avert any uprising or insurrection.
Io conoscevo solo a quell'epoca.
At the time I knew only of a structure made up of people who were anti-communists,
però che poteva essere attivata,
which could be activated only in the event of an invasion of the nation.
Una volta arrestato nel 1974,
I was arrested in 1974 and found myself in an embarrassing situation.
Che il giudice che mi interrogava continuava a farmi degli interrogatori.
The judge was persistently interrogating me until I realized that this judge was probing into what he thought was something revolutionary or unconstitutional.
Anticostituzionale, quella che invece era, a mio
to
avviso,
me it was an organization for national security.
Allora io mi trovavo in questa situazione.
So I found myself in this situation.
Appartenevano pur sempre allo stesso Stato, alla stessa nazione, allo stesso
my superiors
potere.
And the judge belonged to the same system. Could I tell the judge
cose?
Certain
no,
things?
Perché ero vincolato alla segretezza.
No, because of military secrecy.
Era giusto tacere alla giustizia queste cose e lasciare.
Was it legally right to keep quiet and let him go after innocent people?
Allora ho chiesto
this
di parlare
was my dilemma.
Ho chiesto insistentemente. Alla fine,
I wanted to talk to my superiors and finally they brought the general to me.
The general forbade Colonel Amos Piazzi to speak. He was General Vito Micheli, head of the Italian Secret Service. Micheli later invoked state secrecy in order to cover up the existence of the Invisible Legion.
He made signs not to say anything. The judge noticed it. So he was actually signaling yes, while signaling no.
Gianni Flamini, historian.
Lì venne alla luce tutta una organizzazione, soprattutto fondata sul gruppo.
An organization materialized based on extreme right-wing groups.
Radicale che era Ordine Nuovo.
The radical right.
A cui partecipava in qualche modo.
That was the Ordine Nuovo, in which Piazzi participated as a high-ranking artillery officer.
Quando il giudice Tamburino gli fece il mandato di cattura.
One general simply fled when an order for his arrest was issued. This was General Nardella, who has since remained a fugitive, though they say he still receives his salary.
Lieutenant Colonel Amos Spiazzi.
Io sono stato chiamato dal generale Nardella mentre mi.
Whilst I was in the barracks, I was called by General Nardella to the officers' club, where he was the chairman, to meet two or three people. I forget their names. This was in 1971-72. I realized that I was essentially dealing with Freemasons.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
La massoneria internazionale nel dopoguerra.
After the war, international masonry took on the task of participating in the battle against communism. Many army officials, particularly in the high ranks, are masons, as are judges, high-ranking police officials, and cabinotti officers. Neo-fascism couldn't stay outside this phenomenon. Licio Gelli, I have written this and I will always stand by it. He worked for SIM, the military intelligence services, during the war. He went to Yugoslavia following Piero Parini. Gelli was a convicted fascist. He took part in Italy's double game in the Balkans, where he fought Tito with Germans and the Croats with the English. There he obtained certain secrets which meant that after the war he couldn't be marginalized. He went on to play in the big dirty game of Italian espionage. So his career developed within the framework of the secret services.
È continuato questa sua carriera anche nel dopoguerra, sempre nell'ambito dei servizi di sicurezza italiani.
Licio Gelli, Venerable Master of the P2 Masonic Lodge.
Lei deve sapere che la P2,
P2
era
was composed of the best brains of public life,
settori, sia
from the military, from the arts, business, from the civil service or the high finance. We would analyze situations and produce our ideas in writing to MPs.
E si fornivano dopo
they
al Parlamento
reports in order to be able
a chi ne aveva bisogno di queste relazioni per poter migliorare
here.
La situazione.
Vincenzo Vinciquera.
La loggia P2 non è un centro di potere occulto.
The P2 Lodge wasn't a center of hidden power.
Un centro di potere palese, occulto per l'opinione pubblica.
It was a center of real power, hidden from the public, but not from the state. It has played a very precise role in this battle against communism, and I consider the P2 to be one of those parallel structures which were part of Gladio. It didn't have a military role, but rather a role in internal subversion.
Oswald Lewinter.
P2 was basically, I guess you might call it, a wholly owned subsidiary of the company in Italy. The members were people who had been recruited by Gelli for their unswerving loyalty to the cause of anti-communism, I would say conservative democratic principles, and the furtherance of American aims and policies in Western Europe.
Il 69 è l'anno dove l'escalation terroristica.
1969 is the year when terrorism really escalates dramatically.
Comincia nella primavera con
the year starts with attacks in the spring inside the various courtrooms,
con l'attentato contemporaneo,
and worsens in August.
Una decina di treni
with attacks on a series of moving trains. The climax was the massacre in Milan.
Al massimo con la strage a Milano.
Vincenzo Vinciquera.
Il ruolo di Freddy Ventura del gruppo di Padova.
The role of Freedom Ventura's group wasn't the most important. Nor were they solely responsible for the Piazza Fontana.
Come ho già detto anche in sede giudiziaria.
They took part in the attack.
Nell'ottobre del 72.
I explained this during the trial in mid-1972. I stated quite explicitly that others were involved. They were the focal point. They were to take responsibility. They were not alone. Other people took part in the attack. People who weren't from the Padua group and were never identified.
Judge Gerardo Ambruso, investigating magistrate.
Le indagini per la strage di Piazza Fontana.
The investigations into Piazza Fontana progressed with difficulty. Of five bombs placed that day, this one left victims, and there were many. 18 died and 80 were wounded in the attack on the bank. The police never failed to point out, even when they called in the help of international forces,
that
the investigations pointed to the involvement of anarchist groups.
Le indagini erano orientate su gruppi estremistici di natura anarchica.
Franco Freda.
Io mi sono trovato di fronte a uno scherzo di cattivo gusto da parte di.
I was the subject of a bad joke. The judiciary had been manipulated. I was first condemned, then cleared. The verdict was then overturned. I was retried and finally definitely cleared. This political and judicial adventure took 13 years of my life.
Vincenzo Vinciquera.
Piazza Fontana è il momento d'arrivo terminale.
Piazza Fontana is the climax of an operation that was culminated in the declaration of a state of emergency. More than the military behind the Piazza Fontana attack, one sees the Ministry of the Interior and the Office for Secret Affairs. Frieda's group was given the role of executor. They were not the organizers. They simply carried out orders.
Judge Gerardo Ambroso, investigating magistrate.
Various inquiries show that Guido Giannattini had been in Padua during the key days in May. His name was found in Giovanni Ventura's diary.
Guido Giannattini, military intelligence.
In che forma?
I was an outside collaborator with SID, secret services. I gave them information, obviously.
Fornivo delle informazioni, ovviamente.
Captain Antonio Labruna, Italian Secret Service 1964-1983.
Every time Giannettini spoke about his work for Maletti, I didn't understand it, so I made him write it down and give this to Maletti.
Guido Giannettini.
Maletti was the last one to hear, as I worked for the D section of SID. My contact was the head of the section, firstly Colonel Viola, then Colonel Gasker, and General Maletti.
Judge Gerardo Ambroso, investigating magistrate.
Fu fatta una perquisizione a casa di Guido.
A search was carried out in Guido Giannettini's house. By that time he was already out of the country. We found reports in his house which were similar to others, and in a safe deposit box bearing the mark of a particular secret service. The safe deposit box was in a bank in the name of Ventura's mother.
Monte Belluna, cassetta di sicurezza intestata alla madre di Ventura.
Franco Freda.
I believe that among the documents found in the safe deposit box, there were several pages containing the addresses of agents working for the American Secret Services in Italy.
Guido Giannettini, military intelligence.
Io all'inizio conobbi Freda.
Initially, I knew only Freda. He had information on a pro-Chinese group he was involved with. It was the first movement of its kind in Italy. The first groups came out of the Venice region. Consequently, since I lived in Rome, and Freda in Padua, and Ventura traveled frequently between Venice and Rome, he put me in contact with Ventura, and it was he who had direct contact with the extra-parliamentary left in Venice.
Che aveva dei contatti diretti con l'organizzazione della sinistra extraparlamentare del Veneto.
Franco Freda.
La modesta statura di Giannettini, a mio avviso, non si prestava.
In my opinion, Giannettini's modest stature didn't allow for him to be of any use, not even passively. I don't see what use his work as a journalist could have for the secret services of this republic.
Al servizio segreto di questa repubblica.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
They are a provincial group who helped the secret services, as did Ordine Nuovo, Avanguardia, and other less well-known groups. They carried forward a strategy which entailed an infiltration of the left. They all did it. Ordine Nuovo, Avanguardia, and obviously the Padua group. Their attacks were attributed to the left.
E tutti hanno fatto le stesse cose.
Judge Gerardo Ambroso.
Prima linea era,
the first stage was to make attacks which would be blamed on the left.
Ricadere sulla sinistra. La seconda linea invece
the second stage was the actual infiltration of the groups on the left,
gruppi di sinistra,
including these extra-parliamentary groups, to carry out the attacks.
Indurre anche questi gruppi estremistici della sinistra extraparlamentare.
These groups were instrumental in increasing the social and political tension in the country.
Che mirava ad acuire l'attenzione allora sociale e politica nel paese.
Franco Freda.
Neither I nor my friends belong to any political party. We constituted those little forces one defines as extra parliamentary.
Che si definivano allora extraparlamentari.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
Frida firmava rapporti informativi come agente T.
Frida signed his reports, agent T.
Era composto da Frida.
The Padua group consists of Frida calling himself a national socialist, but who in fact worked for the Italian secret services.
Dei servizi di sicurezza italiani.
Massimiliano Facchini, who worked for the Italian secret services, something which General Moletti, as head of Section D, later admitted. Gianni Casalini, informer for the secret services, which was finally been officially recognized, was also a member. Limiting ourselves to three names, we find that in a small group, three members of the leadership were operatives of the Italian military secret services.
Guido Giannettini, military intelligence.
Quando cominciarono a filtrare delle voci.
When rumors started to circulate of my being called to testify at the trial against Freda and Ventura, I interrupted my contact with General Moletti and communicated with Captain Labruna.
Captain Antonio Labruna, Italian Secret Service, 1964-83.
Giannetti was not taken to the frontier. Of his own accord, he said that he had some work to do in France, some journalistic work, so he left. He was simply accompanied to the airport by a low-ranking official.
Accompagnare all'aeroporto da un mio sottufficiale. Tenga a precisare che
Giannetti already had in his possession a return ticket to Paris.
Di un biglietto di andata e ritorno aereo per Parigi,
which wasn't bought for him by the services, but by himself.
Non è stato pagato dal servizio, ma che lui ne era in possesso.
Who has this ticket now?
In possesso di questo biglietto.
For professional reasons, we are careful, even with matters we can't explain. So I have the ticket.
Non sappiamo dire il perché il possesso di questo biglietto ce l'ho io.
Guido Giannettini.
Fu lui che. Quando venne a sapere che era imminente.
When he found out that they were about to search my house, that I was being investigated, Labruna took me to the airport.
Fu appunto Labruna che mi accompagnò a Fiumicino.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
La proposta fatta a me di partecipare all'evasione di Freda.
The suggestion that was put to me to help Freda escape from jail in the autumn of 1973 came from the security forces linked to the Ministry of the Interior. This is proof that they were giving him cover. It was one of the few cases where officials of the military secret services have been tried, namely General Moletti, the Captain Labruna. They were both convicted for aiding and abetting the militant group of Frida and Ventura.
Ai militanti del gruppo Freda Ventura.
Franco Freda.
Io mi sono allontanato da Catanzaro, che era la città in cui
I went away from Catanzaro, which was the town where I was obliged to live. I didn't run away for your information. As far as Ventura is concerned, we left Italy at different times with different means and different help.
Con aiuti diversi.
Che aiuti?
What help?
Aiuti personali.
Help from friends.
Judge Gerardo Ambroso.
In quel momento là noi avevamo Guido Giannettini a disposizione che stavamo sottoponendo ad interrogatorio.
At that moment we had Giannettini in for questioning.
Era alla nostra attenzione l'attività soprattutto svolta da Guido Giannettini.
We were paying attention to the role played by him in this affair. Certo
che Guido Giannettini era
We had also discovered that Giannettini was one of those who believed in the so-called Revolutionary War.
E aveva fatto un intervento. La cosa estremamente interessante era che questo
conference had the patronage of the Chief of Staff of Defense.
E che
Praticamente l'intervento di Giannettini non era solamente.
What was also interesting was that Giannettini's speech wasn't only on the Revolutionary War,
adottate per contrastare.
But on measures to be adopted to prevent the takeover of power by the communists.
E questa,
this strategy of counter-revolutionary war advocated provoking a social tension to demonstrate the danger of the left, danger that could be demonstrated by carrying out attacks that could be ascribed to the left and through infiltration of the left.
Doveva essere evidenziato attraverso attentati, ma anche compiuti facendoli ricadere sulla sinistra, ma anche attraverso infiltrazioni.
Guido Giannettini.
Maletti, let us say, helped me a lot even when I was abroad. At a certain point, he was obligated to abandon me. Those who work for intelligence know that this happens.
Franco Freda. The life of everyone is manipulated by those with more power. Plato said that we men are puppets in the hands of ideas. In my case, I accept that I have been a puppet in the hands of ideas, but not in the hands of men from secret services here or abroad. That is to say that I have voluntarily fought my own war following the strategic design which came from my own ideas. That is all. Vincenzo Vinciquera.
The massacre at Bologna came at the time of maximum concern on the part of the Italian, American, and Allied secret services because of the electoral success of the Italian Communist Party. The massacre at Bologna responded, as do all the other massacres, to the logic of a state who, no longer knowing how to confront a political enemy, resorts to extreme measures of violence attributable to extremists on the left or the right in order to justify their own actions. That is the only truth about Bologna.
Non c'è altra verità sulla strage di Bologna.
Licio Gelli, venerable master of the P2 Masonic Lodge.
Io non credo che nessuno abbia messo la bomba a Bologna. Quello è stato un incidente di trasporto.
There was no bomb at Bologna. It was a transport problem. Explosives were almost sold in the supermarkets.
Senz'altro erano gente che lo trasportavano.
Somebody came from the east with three bundles.
Si sono fermati.
They were probably taking them somewhere else. They had stopped there. It was the 2nd of August, an extremely hot day. Someone threw a cigarette away, as happens. The people carrying the explosives were among the three bodies that were never identified.
Federico D'Umberto D'Amato, head of the Political Police and Ministry of Interior, 1972 to 1974.
Even under the communist or fascist regimes, which are usually the strongest when it comes to police powers, it's not easy to uncover who's behind the bombing. It's one of the vilest crimes possible and one of the easiest to commit.
It's
like a bomb and you leave. It's as simple as that. There is no evidence left because the explosion destroys everything. You never find anything afterwards. The attacks could have been carried out by anyone and everyone.
There is no evidence that the Americans paid the terrorists or those who ordered the bombings. But secret CIA documents do reveal a pattern of payments to people connected with the Italian secret services, some of whom knew nothing at all about Gladio's role in bombings and kidnappings.
Oswald Lewinter.
There's a MIBS document which lists people and their importance and what they received monthly. For instance, a fellow named Guido Giannettini, on a scale, it was a 5, and he only received $1,000 a month. Now, Tino Rauti was at 2. He received 4,000 a month. Sarah Valley was a 1 and got 6,000 a month. Alavena was a 1. He got 5,000. Micheli was a 1 who got 5,000 a month. D'Amato was a 1 who was paid out of an embassy fund. Cauchy was a 5. He was paid directly by Licio Gelli.
Third and final part of the trilogy is entitled The Foot Soldiers.
Thirty years of innocence and peace in Belgium were shattered in the early 1980s. Citizens with no expectations of violence were murdered while shopping. No one knew who, no one knew why. Some suspected that right-wing elements in the secret services had penetrated left-wing groups and had even killed their own police to deflect attention from themselves. The suspicion was never proven, but nor did it ever go away.
We hear an extract from a U.S. intelligence field manual.
Top secret. There may be times when host country governments show passivity or indecision in the face of communist subversion. U.S. Army intelligence must have the means of launching special operations which will convince host country governments and public opinion of the reality of the insurgent danger. U.S. Army intelligence should seek to penetrate the insurgency by means of agents on special assignment with the task of forming special action groups among the most radical elements of the insurgency.
William Colby, Director of the CIA, 1973-76.
I never heard such a thing, frankly. I don't know the origin of the statement, and you can find any statement in any country. I mean, you can find jackass statements anywhere.
I suspect it is an authentic document. I don't doubt it. I never saw it, but it's the kind of special forces military operations that are described. On the other hand, you've got to recall that the Defense Department and the President don't initiate any of those orders until there is an appropriate occasion.
Oswald Lewinter.
This is Supplement B of Field Manual 3132. It's 12 pages long. It's not a hell of a big thing, but if it's not authentic, then you need to ask somebody what is it doing in the classified manual section of most field manual libraries.
Licio Gelli, head of the P2 Masonic Lodge.
The document was given to me by a friend in the CIA. Before entering a session, he said, read this when you have time.
Michael Ledeen, State Department consultant in Italy, shakes his head.
The field manual is an old forgery designed to show that there's some kind of accusing the United States basically of what the Soviet Union was doing in Italy, which was creating a secret underground paramilitary organization capable of acting to subvert Italian democracy.
Lucien Dazlier, former Belgian para-commander.
I'm from the north of the province of Luxembourg. At the time, I was manager of a bank as well as an ex-para commando. One day, some people came to my house and asked for my help with some special maneuvers in coordination with the American special forces. The Belgian commandos were told to recover American paratroopers. After this operation, they were to go to predetermined spots and attack barracks belonging to the gendarmerie. I had with me the supplies, the weapons, and the radio transmitter for coordinating it all.
René Hacquin, journalist.
Un dimanche matin, nous avons appris dans les journaux, à la radio.
We read in the papers about an attack on a military camp of the Chasseurs Ardennes here in Belgium. I went there along with other journalists. They had cut the fences, attacked the armory, wounded the guard, and left with a certain number of weapons. I was able to get into the camp because I knew some people there. Inside, I saw foreign military personnel, notably Americans.
Et à l'intérieur du camp, je me suis aperçu qu'il y avait des militaires étrangers, notamment des Américains.
Lucien Dazler, former Belgian paracommander.
Quelques jours avant, il y avait eu des bavures, c'est-à-dire que les Américains.
There had been trouble a few days before. The Americans had gone too far.
Dans la quarantaine, tous officiers. C'est comme des mecs solides.
These were people in their 40s, officers, tough guys.
Ils ont attaqué une caserne de gendarmerie dans la région de Château. Ils ont même balancé une grenade.
They attacked the barracks before. They had even thrown a grenade near the attorney general's office.
Une réaction du pouvoir civil.
The civilian authorities reacted, saying this was too much.
Donc c'est à ce moment-là que
l'attaque
à la caserne qui était programmée,
et
qui avait déjà été repérée 3 jours avant, a été annulée. Le jour
the day of the attack, we were told that it had been cancelled.
On nous a prévenu que ça ne se passerait pas.
But the Americans asked me to drive them to the camp as a standby.
En standby pour attaquer la caserne.
The next morning, I went with my wife to Namur.
Avec mon épouse ici de l'autre côté de Namur.
I heard on the radio that the barracks had been attacked at midnight. I can't say what happened because I had left at 8 p.m. that evening. I wasn't supposed to stay.
À 8 heures du soir, moi, je suis parti. J'ai prévenu, moi je ne reste pas pour les opérations.
René Haka, journalist.
Et pendant des semaines et des mois,
for weeks and months,
que les enquêteurs civils nous donnaient,
the explanation the civil authorities gave us
une attaque menée soit par des bandits,
was that the attack was the work of common criminals or of terrorists.
Il a fallu attendre plusieurs mois
pour it was several months before I received the telephone call.
Et c'est ainsi que je suis allé en France.
That's how I went to France and met Lucien Dislair, who gave me his report and talked to me at length. He told me he had taken part in a secret maneuver, which was to reproduce the operations of the resistance and of support for the resistance, as it was done at the end of the war.
Lucien Dazler.
Le surlendemain, que j'ai reçu un coup de téléphone.
The following day, the commander of the Ville-Salm barracks called me and updated me on the operation.
Il m'a dit, voilà,
he told me to tell the Belgian commando that the guard wasn't dead, he was in hospital, seriously wounded.
Et nous l'avons conduit à l'hôpital à Liège.
René Haka.
Le samedi.
The Saturday evening of the attack, his role had been to take a military team in plain clothes to the Ville-Salm camp. The plan was to attack that night. The American and Belgian authorities who were questioned ended up admitting, after months, that there had been an exercise.
Qu'il y avait bien eu.
Admitted that certain attacks had taken place.
Cette manœuvre, on avait bien organisé certaines attaques.
I remember, for example,
qu'il a été question
attack on a military fuel depot in Bastogne.
Une autre attaque la nuit.
Another attack on a police station at Neufchâteau.
À Neufchâteau. Lentement, les militaires ont
gradually, the military admitted there had been certain attacks, but their last version of Ville-Salm was that an attack had been planned but had been cancelled at the last moment. Some of the arms stolen at Ville-Salm were found in a flat belonging to the Cellule Communiste
Combattante.
But journalists and observers continued to ask, had the terrorists been at Ville-Salm?
Ou bien si peut-être on
were the guns planted in their apartment to make it look that way? Is that the editor's office? We want to tell you that we have left a message for you at 26 Avenue General de Gaulle in the entrance under the letterbox.
In cases where the infiltration of agents into the insurgent leadership has not been effectively implemented, it may help to utilize ultra-leftist organizations.
Senator Roger Lallemand, head of the Belgian parliamentary inquiry into Gladio.
In the 1980s, a kind of media terrorism developed here, which used the media to shock the public and foreign circles. This terrorism could have two sources, the extreme left or right, or it could be foreign governments and foreign intelligence services. It is a terrorism which aims to destabilize democratic society.
Minister Guy Coëm, Belgian Defense Minister, 1988 to 1991.
In Belgium, there have been a number of unexplained events. An armed band committed numerous murders in the mid-80s. And we still know nothing about this. It has been suggested that their aim was to destabilize the democratic regime in our country.
We see the bloody aftermath of the shootings in Belgium.
He saw three masked men coming out of the rear. He said to his child, "Drop down, there they are." One bystander who tried to flee was shot at. Seven or eight bullets through his car and a shot grazing behind the car.
One woman whose face was covered in blood was screaming something about her child. I don't know exactly what.
Blacked out face of Marcia Ligge, Belgian gendarme, 1972 to 1984.
My name is Marcia Ligge. I used to be with the Belgian gendarmerie. I left Belgium in August 84 after precise death threat against my kids. In beginning of December 1983, I did go personally to the BSR, who were doing the investigation about the killing. I was surprised that no arrest had been made, and I knew that I did report myself what was going on, and we were expecting killing like that, random killing, going to supermarket and killing people, and even kids. I believe they killed about 30 people. So I told a gentleman I met, Leur Lies, member of the gendarmerie or the army, are there involved in that. His answer was, shut up, you know, we know. Take care of your own business, get out of here. What they were saying, the democracy was going away, the leftists were in power, the socialists and all these things, they wanted more power.
This crime troubled the public as it didn't seem to be justified by the sole consideration of profit for what could have been grabbed from the supermarkets.
De ce que l'on pouvait prendre dans des grands magasins.
The gratuitous killing of people could have been a political motive.
Personne pouvait procéder d'une intention politique.
One recalls what happened in Italy at the station in Bologna, where 80 innocent people died. We think a political organization was behind the Brabant Wallon killings.
Jean-Claude Garot edited and owned the Belgian magazine Pool. In its pages, he ran a series of exposés of Belgian neo-fascist groups.
Jean-Claude Garot.
L'organisation du Front de la Jeunesse.
The Front de la Jeunesse had existed for several years.
Une nouvelle structure, mais avec des
it was new, but its members had been in other political groups before that.
Avant cela, dans d'autres structures.
Francis Tossogne, head of Front de la Jeunesse.
The Front de la Jeunesse was born in 1974 and existed until the 80s. At times it was a political group, at times militant, extreme right-wing, but essentially it was a militant youth movement.
Jean-Claude Garot.
There was Jean Europe, Front de la Jeunesse. The names of these organizations change, but you often find the same people in these groups. Dossogne was in several of them.
Francis Dossogne, head of Front de la Jeunesse.
Alors on a mené toute une série d'actions, le
Front de la Jeunesse carried out actions which upset things.
Parce que nous remettions en question une série de choses.
It put many things into question.
Qui étaient relativement bien établies, ou si vous voulez, relativement bien établies. Et le Front de la Jeunesse a beaucoup dérangé.
The Front upset things so much they wanted to destroy it.
Le casser.
Jean-Claude Garot.
On soupçonnait qu'il y avait un centre nerveux.
One suspects that there was a nerve center taking the decisions.
Était entouré de cercles successifs.
And this was surrounded by concentric circles to which tasks were delegated.
Avec naturellement un problème, c'est que plus
naturally there was a problem.
Quand elles arrivaient au cercle périphérique,
as you moved away from the center, errors were committed.
Il y avait des erreurs. Dans les Ardennes, c'était un
une des erreurs was a functional error.
Pour recréer, disons, l'ensemble de
in the training of their groups for active incident and paramilitary groups,
actifs, donc
they had to form and train elements of the extreme right
et d'encadrer des éléments d'extrême droite.
Ex-paracommandos,
anciens paracommandos,
ex-militaires, gendarmes, militant rightists,
militants d'extrême droite.
Francis Dossogne. Head of Front de la Jeunesse.
On a condamné les militants du Front de la Jeunesse pour avoir tenu des camps.
The Front were condemned for their camps.
In fact,
what we did was just what scouts do. What some companies do in incentive courses goes much further.
Plus que ce que le Front de la Jeunesse n'a jamais fait.
Jean-Claude Garot.
Une de ces organisations flamandes, VMO,
one of the Flemish organizations, VMO, Vlaams Militant Den Oude,
et qu'ils désiraient entraîner.
Had a combat section, which they wanted to train.
Dans les Ardennes.
They did this in a camp at the Ardennes.
On emploie des tirs de
this kind of exercise involves the firing of machine guns.
De grenades, ça fait du bruit.
Throwing of grenades.
Ça éveille des attentions.
Donc, nous this avons makes noise and attracts attention.
Que ce camp
we were told that this camp
et nous avons,
was taking place.
Mis
we knew about it and organized the necessary photographic equipment
de l'action.
In order to photograph part of the action.
Cette action dans un contexte très
then we revealed
étudié.
Their activities in a very deliberate fashion.
Nous
we said,
y a eu un camp d'entraînement militaire
we believe there is a VMO military training camp in the Ardennes
fusil
where they use machine guns
and
Molotov cocktails.
Dans les Ardennes.
Francis Dossogne.
Le Front de la Jeunesse n'avait pas de camp militaire en tant que tel.
The Front didn't have military camps, but camping which took place on private land. But rumors circulated. The Front de la Jeunesse was authorized by the military authorities. Everything was above board.
Tout ça se faisait au vu et au su de tout le monde.
Jean-Claude Garot.
Des amis de la radio, de la télévision, en connexion avec moi.
With friends from the radio and TV, we interviewed General Beurir.
Le général Beurir. Qui était à
at that time, he was number one in the hierarchy of the gendarmerie.
General Beurir, c'était le
in the interview, he said, that never happened.
En interview, télévision et radio, a dit,
the same day, the examining judge intervened.
Le jour même, le juge
but where?
Intervenait, mais
here,
intervenait où cela?
They searched the premises and made a statement.
Ici, et en faisant une déclaration à la presse en disant,
Garot has lied.
Jean-Claude Garot
he has fabricated uniforms, photos and arms.
Il a fabriqué avec des uniformes, des photos et des armes, toute une mascarade.
Francis Dossogne, head of Front de la Jeunesse.
Le groupe G était en fait une des sections du Front de la Jeunesse.
Group G was a section of the Front in the Gendarmerie.
Qui pour des raisons déontologiques liées
as gendarmes, they didn't want to be mixed up with the rest.
Avec les autres. Et par conséquent,
and risked being involved during demonstrations and so on.
Qui ne peuvent pas faire déontologiquement apparent.
This dozen young gendarmes asked to be put in a separate section.
Petite dizaine grand maximum. Ces gendarmes avaient demandé d'être regroupés dans une section à part.
Marshal Lecoeur. Belgian gendarme, 1972 to 1984.
Mr. Francis Dossogne was the contact. I've been recruited by another member of the gendarmerie from headquarters to become a member of that group. Only police officer was inside that group. It was called the Group G, G for gendarmerie.
Francis Dossogne, head of Front de la Jeunesse.
Lecoeur fait partie du groupe G.
Lecoeur
was part of Group G.
He was one of its first members.
He was so much part of Group G
that he later informed the chief of staff of the gendarmerie of its existence.
And I did witness there Mr. Mievis, he's the one who did recruit me, giving to Mr. Dossogne a confidential file from headquarters. The people they did recruit were people like myself, people from headquarters, people who have access to certain knowledge inside the gendarmerie. So I believe officers in headquarters were involved also.
Jean-Claude Garot.
Paul Latinus a été découvert.
I discovered Paul Latinus by chance during an interview. I soon began an inquiry which showed how Latinus had been implanted into Front de la Jeunesse
dans le Front de la Jeunesse avec des missions
with a specific task
d'apprendre au Front de la Jeunesse
to teach Front de la Jeunesse how to carry out violent acts,
attaques de café,
attacks on immigrant Arab cafes,
how
to organize military training camps,
how
to carry out surveillance.
Surveillance.
Michel Libert, Westland New Post, 1978-1981.
The structure of Westland New Post, it's always the same principle. You have a chief of staff at the top. Under him, two management groups which provide financial help or assistance from the respective authorities. The top people are unknown. They're only known as the key people. In Europe, there were nine key people, and one was Paul Latinus. The world anti-communist couldn't act in all parts of the world. And when they wanted something done, who would they use? Comrades of the same system. Europe is divided into eight with a center. This central group includes Belgium, West Germany, Northern France, and Holland.
René Hacquin, journalist.
Latinus was charged with forming an army on the model of the SS. They had a secret service, a security service in the group. Each member has a double name, a code name, usually in German. The members didn't know the others. They were grouped together according to age. Each recruit didn't know the other team members.
Celui qui était recruté ne connaissait pas les autres membres de l'équipe.
Michel Libert, Westland New Post, 1978-1981.
On peut créer une branche action.
The fittest members can form an action branch.
On peut créer une branche.
And one can form an intellectual branch.
Ce sont ceux qui vont,
they will be responsible for intelligence.
Qui vont gérer le renseignement. Donc de l'information,
thus, information, de l'action, action, and the universities.
L'université, pourquoi? Parce qu'on a parfois
why the universities? Often one has need for scientific help, for a lab. Just as in a judicial office, there's always a lab. Whose is the hair? We didn't go that far, but we did use chemicals. A request for explosives would go to the university branch. We're not talking about TNT, but of much more specialized products.
René Hacquin, journalist.
Je reprends contact avec Paul Latinus.
I contacted Latinus again.
Dans un restaurant de province.
We met in a restaurant and talked all night.
Au cours de laquelle il me raconte qu'il a été chargé.
Certain authorities, he wouldn't say which at first,
de constituer depuis plusieurs années en Belgique,
had given him the job of creating a secret resistance group in Belgium.
Pour, lutter contre,
it was to fight Soviet penetration. Soviétique. And stop certain Belgian authorities from collaborating with the Soviets.
Michel Libert, Westland New Post.
Des opérations commanditées, des opérations commandées.
When an operation was to be carried out, Latinus was given the job.
Doit être certain
to get us to do it,
en cas de problème.
He had to have an aide in case of any problems.
Des moins jeunes sur le terrain.
You can't send younger members into the field.
Within
2 hours, they would have a bullet between the eyes.
There
were always risks. They could be stopped by the local police for an identity check. The police turn up like a hare in the soup. One can't say, we're here in such and such a mission. Doing what? Can't tell you. Click the handcuffs, and that's it.
Tout à fait classique.
René Hacquin, journalist.
Dans ce groupe,
one member of this group was an inspector from the Secret Service.
Qui a dit plus tard qu'il infiltrait ce groupe.
He later admitted that he was an infiltrator.
A donné
but he said he had only given courses in surveillance in an apartment belonging to one of their members. This inspector wore a balaclava. And he was accompanied by a guard.
Sur la tête, accompagné d'un garde.
His code name was Colonel. He had a WNP membership card. The secret code of the organization.
Michel Libert, Westland New Post.
Et parmi les techniciens qu'il a fait venir,
among the technicians who gave courses, there was a member of the EEC security services called
Robert.
Another member always wore a balaclava during his lectures.
It
turned out to be an inspector from the secret services.
Un commissaire de la sûreté de l'État, Smets.
René Hacquin.
Et lorsque nous avons posé des questions sur ces cours,
when asking about these courses, we wondered if he had organized exercises after the courses.
Et le commissaire,
the inspector ended up admitting that he had
été sur les lieux d'un exercice
in Brussels in May 1984.
On avait dit
he had told the young members
que une jeune femme
that the terrorist Carlos's mistress lived there and asked them to trail her day and night.
De surveiller cette femme jour et nuit.
Michel Libert.
Ces personnes ont donné des cours.
These people gave courses in recruitment, surveillance and arms.
Robert a donné des cours de placement
Robert
d'explosifs
gave
dans les
courses on explosives,
a donné des cours
on
de
arms
démontage,
and shooting,
montage, l'armement
and in how to kill without leaving a trace.
Également de tuer sans laisser de trace.
René Hacquin.
When we met up in the following days and weeks, I asked Latinus, who had asked him to build the group. He mentioned the state security. We have verified that he did work for the state security. He talked to foreign military authorities. I pushed him, and eventually he said American military secret services.
Les services secrets militaires américains.
Michel Libert.
Je confirme, il a rencontré des gens.
He met people from the embassy, but I never met them like we met now.
Comme je vous rencontre aujourd'hui à 2 mètres de distance, c'était pas le cas.
It wasn't my domain.
C'était pas mon domaine d'activité. Lui, c'était.
His was, you might say, the domain of diplomacy, that is, relations with foreign authorities.
Les autorités étrangères.
Our sole concern was with action.
On sait qu'on est protégé, on sait que l'on a.
We knew we were protected by all possible authorities, depending on the type of mission.
Par le type de mission qui est engagé.
Was he paid by the Americans?
Est-ce qu'il était à la solde des Américains?
I can't say, but he was in contact with them.
Relation suivie, ça oui, de toute façon.
René Hacquin.
Nous avons appris qu'il y avait eu un autre exercice.
We now know of another exercise here in January and February 1984.
On avait dit à ces jeunes qu'il y avait un couple.
These young men were told of a couple living in Brussels who were probably KGB agents and had to be watched.
Il fallait le surveiller.
Then, when we heard that this exercise had taken place, we remembered that in February 1982,
qu'en février 1982,
this couple had been found, strangled and shot.
Et abattu de balles dans la tête.
Michel Libert.
On reçoit des plans. Bon, par exemple, on va reprendre.
One received orders. We can go back to say 82.
De 82 à 85, il y a des projets.
From 82 to 85, there were projects.
Vous ne connaissez rien.
You, Mr. Libert. Know nothing about why we're doing this, nothing at all. All we ask is that your group, with cover from the gendarmerie, with cover from security, carry out a job. Target, the supermarkets. Where are they? What kind of locks are there? What sort of protection do they have that could interfere with our operation? Does the store manager lock up? Or do they use an outside security company? We carried out the orders and sent in our reports. Hours of opening and closing, everything you want to know about a supermarket.
Les heures d'ouverture, les heures de fermeture, les.
What was this for? This was one among hundreds of missions.
Savoir pourquoi il y a
something that had to be done.
C'est une parmi des centaines de missions.
But the use it was all put to
Maintenant, l'usage qui en fera.
That's the big question.
Ce que l'on en fera plus tard, ça c'est le grand point d'interrogation.
And the screen shows a Belgian supermarket through the eyes of a carnival mask.
Where were the victims killed?
Some in the car park, some inside.
Before, during or after the hold-up?
Before, during and after.
I simply saw someone with one of those carnival masks and a gun.
Ridiculous. It couldn't have been more than 200.
They weren't after the money?
I can't say.
He had a sort of carnival mask. He had a big gun. I don't know of what kind. And when I moved forward, he gestured to me. Naturally, I didn't ask for my bill. I went towards the rear of the store.
Martial Lequeux, Belgian gendarme.
The guns they were using were coming from far away. And that's exactly what we did plan. It's to organize gangs and groups like that and let them go by themselves, but make sure they will survive and make sure to supply them and, you know, just to create a climate of terror in a country.
After 4 years of random killings and hold-ups, the Brabant-Wallon killers vanished. Then, after a year of silence, a phone call led police to a sack in a Belgian canal. In it, they found the weapons used in the killings and much of the loot. The caller never identified himself.
They have two plans. Once, the first one was to organize gangs to do hold-up, hostage, you know, killing. The second one was to organize a so-called left movement who will do a terrorist attempt, just to make the population believe that these terrorist attempts were done by the left.
In Belgium, as in the rest of Europe, the 1968 student revolts in Paris, Brussels, Frankfurt and Milan led to the emergence of armed leftist action groups. The Red Army faction, Baader-Meinhof, Action Directe, and the Red Brigades, Le Brigate Rosse. On March 16, 1978, the Italian left-wing terrorists kidnapped the former Italian Prime Minister, Mr. Aldo Moro. On that day, the Italian Parliament was about to debate the inclusion of the Italian Communist Party in a government of national unity for the first time since 1948. Aldo Moro had long believed that this was the only solution for political stability in Italy.
Oswald Lewinter.
Brigata Rosso was penetrated. Baader-Meinhof was penetrated. Action Directe, various of these left-wing terrorist organizations were penetrated and co-opted.
Federico Umberto D'Amato, head of the Italian Political Police, Ministry of the Interior, 1972-74.
The Red Brigades were infiltrated with some difficulty because they were a closed organization, very efficient. But there were some important and very successful infiltrators.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
Federico Umberto D'Amato.
The Amato started in the secret services of the police forces and the Ministry of the Interior in the fascist era and in the ensuing years. His father was chief of police and was employed by the police in purging committee in 1945 and 46. In his work, he always maintained contact with the secret services.
Federico Umberto D'Amato.
Si è fatto anche di più nel campo della sicurezza.
We did a lot in the field of security, especially on a European scale, after the French événements, or the Revolution of 68. There was a real threat posed by the subversive elements in Europe. So I proposed we set up a permanent committee, a European committee, one which even Switzerland joined. Indeed, this committee is even called the Bern Club.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
Viamato was founder of the Bern Club. It was his idea. It includes all the secret services of Europe and America, the first appearance of this group, and the internal political battle is seen in 1972 with the so-called Operation Chinese Poster. They gave an extreme right-wing group, El Avanguardia Nazionale, the task of putting Maoist posters. This was in effect an attempt to create the ultra-left, even more extreme than the Communist Party. The Bern Club drew this up at a meeting of the secret services of Europe, America, and China.
Federico Umberto D'Amato.
The club still exists and brings together the secret services of Europe together. Every time they meet, because I was the founder, they send me a greeting to the godfather. That's me.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
The Red Brigades were well known and infiltrated. All the members of the Red Brigades were well known to the police and the secret services.
Alberto Franceschini, founding member of the Red Brigades.
A few other comrades and myself
went to Rome to stage an assault.
Un salto, dicevamo, politico e militare.
After our kidnapping of a judge, the plan was to kidnap a politician.
Un magistrato, il nostro obiettivo era il sequestro di un
uomo. We decided that it would be Andreotti.
Individuato appunto questa persona in Andreotti. Non arrivammo nemmeno a preparare.
We hadn't even drawn up a plan of action because suddenly Renato and I were both arrested.
Io fui arrestato, io e Renato fummo arrestati tutti.
Questo
nostro interno, il fratello Mitra, era ormai un anno
been in contact with our organization for a year.
Con noi, con la nostra organizzazione. Avrebbe avuto l'opportunità di infiltrarsi.
If he had wanted to, he could have infiltrated us even further.
Perché dopo quell'appuntamento che lui aveva con Renato,
after his meeting with Renato, we were going to ask him to become head of our military training.
La militare. Lui a questo punto avrebbe avuto l'opportunità di conoscere.
He would have had an opportunity to meet all the clandestine members.
E la cosa che può colpire è che proprio quella volta hanno deciso
why they chose to strike at that very moment.
Arrestare le persone.
Franceschini and Renato Curcio, the founders of the Red Brigades, were in prison when Aldo Moro was kidnapped.
Oswald Le Winter.
Scores of reports, classified documents coming out of the Rome station, which absolutely verified that, you know, that the Red Brigades had been penetrated, that the planning staff of the Red Brigades was taking its orders from Santovita.
General Santovita was then head of SISMI, the Italian secret service.
Gianni Ciprani, journalist.
Valerio Morucci, il brigatista che fu arrestato.
Valerio Morucci of the Red Brigades, arrested after the murder of Moro, had on him a diary full of documents and phone numbers and highly confidential notes. Amongst those were details of General Giovanni Romeo, head of D Department in SID, the Secret Services, the most important office during the kidnapping of Aldo Moro. Bear in mind it was General Romeo who, last year, declared to the commission dealing with the massacres that he had agents inside the Red Brigades.
Le Brigate Rosse.
Senator Libero Gualtieri, head of the Italian parliamentary inquiry into Gladio.
We don't know whether we have identified everyone involved in the shooting of Moro. It has been said that there was an officer of the secret services in the area. When interrogated, he said he had legitimate reasons to be in the vicinity.
Gianni Ciprani, journalist.
Guglielmi was first mentioned after Per Luigi Ravasio's confession, a carabinieri who had worked for military intelligence, SISMI. Ravasio, when he was a SISMI agent, had been trained at the Gladio base at Capo Maraggio. He said that at the University of Rome the services had an informer who warned them that Moro would be kidnapped on 16th March 1978. He also said that Colonel Guglielmi had been in Via Fani. He had witnessed the kidnapping but had been unable to prevent it. Ravasio also said that Guglielmi was dead, but he was not. He was being interrogated by a Roman judge and had partially confirmed Ravasio's story by saying he was in the area but had no part in the kidnap. What stands out in Guglielmi's statements is the fact that he said that he went to his father's house for lunch, but it all happened at 9 in the morning, a little early for lunch. He was in the intelligence bureau of the Ministry of the Interior. Evidence implies he was also a trainer at the Gladio base at Capo Maraggio.
Aldo Moro's widow. Either my husband or someone else told me, perhaps from 1975 onwards, or perhaps a little after 1975, I can't be more precise, that he had been told that this attempt of his to bring all the political forces together in the government for the good of the country was something that was not appreciated by certain groups of people. And if he persisted in his efforts to follow up these ideas of his, if he insisted on going ahead with his political plan, he would pay dearly for it. Alberto Franceschini, founding member of the Red Brigades.
La mia reazione, non solo la mia, ma un po' di tutti noi, è stata di grande stupore.
My reaction, we all felt the same, was one of amazement. I was stunned, first of all because of who Moro was, and because of his importance.
I compagni fuori avessero la forza e la capacità di portare a termine un sequestro, un intervento così complesso come era quello del Moro presidente, in quel momento. Quello che ci aveva colpito e meravigliato era quella che più fu chiamata la geometrica potenza delle Brigate Rosse, perché noi ci ricordavamo un'organizzazione fatta da ragazzi anche con poca esperienza militare, che nel giro di pochissimi anni era
suddenly capable of carrying out such a militarily complex act
as
the kidnapping of
Moro,
and this in the center of Rome.
E nel centro di Roma.
49 of the 92 bullets that were found in the Via Fani were covered in a special coating and had no date of manufacture. The first investigation referred to the bullets used by special forces, not by conventional forces.
Pronto?
Hello? Who is this talking?
Irrespective of the fact that your phone is tapped, you are to take a final message to the Moro family.
Who is this talking?
The Red Brigades. Tell them that they will find the body of Aldo Moro in Via Caetani, okay?
In Via Caetani. Va bene?
Yes.
There they will find a red Renault 4. The first numbers on the plate are N5.
Must I phone them myself?
No, you must go there.
I can't.
Can't? You have to.
Please, no.
I cannot accept the disgraceful and ungrateful decision taken by the Christian Democratic Party. I will not absolve, nor will I exonerate anyone of their responsibility. No political or moral reason impels me to do so. My own cry joins that of my family, themselves wounded to death, and I hope that their cry will be heard independently. I don't believe the Christian Democratic Party has solved their problems by liquidating Morrow. Because of this clear incompatibility, I request that at my funeral there be no one present representing the Italian state and no one from the political party. I ask to be accompanied by the few people who have really wished me well, those therefore that are worthy of accompanying me with their prayers and with their love. Kind regards, Aldo Moro.
Francesco Cossiga, President of Italy, 1985 to 1992.
Nella Democrazia Cristiana, la morte di Aldo Moro pesa ancora.
Aldo Moro's death weighs heavily upon the Christian Democrats, as does the decision I came to, which turned my hair white to practically sacrifice Moro to save the Republic.
Gianni Ciprani, journalist.
In the Red Brigade's printing offices, found directly after Moro's death, a printing press was found which had belonged to the secret services, the RUS section, the unit of special recruitment, the section in the secret services that recruited the gladiators.
Michael Ledeen, State Department consultant. Italy.
By the time that Moro's body was discovered, the Italians had worked themselves into such a frenzy and such a terror about the Red Brigades that I think if the Red Brigades had appreciated just how frightened the Italian government was at that point, that they might actually have accomplished something. I mean, accomplished something political. The goal of terrorism, after all, is to terrorize. They had succeeded in terrorizing. They had terrorized the political class of Italy.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
When I talk about ideals, I mean the pursuit of truth, not ideology. I believe that the fascism was a historical experience which has simply faded. So the pursuit of truth doesn't just refer to the past, but also to the present and the future. These ideals prevent me from repenting my deeds. Because what I did was something I thought was right. I profoundly believed in what I was doing and still do. So I can't disassociate myself from the past. It wasn't the truth that the state denies, and I can't even complete accepting the rewards the state gives to those who lie and are obedient, because thousands of people have been deceived, jailed, and killed.
Alberto Franceschini, founding member of the Red Brigades.
Personalmente vorrei sapere anche perché mi sto facendo 17 anni di carcere.
Why am I spending 17 years in jail? I want to know what or who has used me. When I thought I was going in one direction, that someone was moving me in the opposite direction.
Senza che io me ne rendessi conto.
I want to know.
Mi faceva procedere in un'altra direzione. Io vorrei saperlo.
Federico Umberto D'Amato, head of the political police, Italian Ministry of the Interior, 1972 to 74.
Questi pupazzi, questi che i francesi chiamano automat.
These puppets, as the French call them, automats, we call them automi, from the word automatos, that is, automated puppets. It is the attempt to give life to something that is lifeless, but whose movements and gestures are really quite charming. Here is a puppet which sums up what we have been talking about. This is the puppet of politics. This is the conjurer. the jongleur.
Le jongleur.
And the film ends with Federico Umberto D'Amato watching the musical box. The puppet moves as if by itself, and not only that, it's carrying out a magic trick. Now, many thanks to everybody who lent their voice to that film adaptation. Definitely the most ambitious film adaptation we have yet undertaken on Unwelcome Guests, and I think one of the most worthy of films. Hearty congratulations to the late Alan Frankovich. Bears repeating that he died in extremely suspicious circumstances, supposedly of a heart attack while going through customs at an international airport in the US. Now, I didn't have long to expound on the surveillance terrorism complex, the nexus between the two, but with all these false flag terrorist attacks going on, it becomes essential to control the flow of information. That means you can't carry out these false flag terrorist attacks without the surveillance industrial complex on board. Now, Paul Latinus, Wikipedia, reports suffered a suicide. It doesn't even say it's an alleged suicide last time I checked. Somebody was concerned enough, we don't know who, to compile a 698-page investigation, and that has found its way onto WikiLeaks. If you're interested in reviewing Wikipedia and constructing alternative hypotheses, citing relevant information, which is still available on the web, then I'd invite you to join at wikispooks.com, an alternative encyclopedia for those who have had enough of the official narrative behoven to government and authority reports, and those who would rather trust their eyes and ears. This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. And spread it out equal, just like the Bible.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Our renewable future, Richard Heinberg, how to get there from here. This is the second part of a one-hour speech. Richard Heinberg's books and films on energy and his ongoing collaborations with his colleagues at the Post-Carbon Institute made him an inspiration for the international localization and transition town movements. In part one of this program, he gave an analysis of fossil fuel supply, climate risk, and the real power behind fracking in the U.S. Here now is his three-level plan for the transition to renewable energy. He's touching on food production, transportation, housing, manufacturing, steel and cement construction, mining, the internet, and much more, all in 24 minutes. He calls this the economic transformation for the remainder of our lives. Richard Heinberg.
This energy transition is going to be a big deal
And if we want to accomplish it successfully, it's going to be good for us to think of it in terms of levels of difficulty. I'm not going to call it stages, because stages would imply, well, we're going to do stage one, then we're going to finish that and go to stage two, and so on. We're actually going to have to start with all of these things at the same time, but it's good to have some sense of the low-hanging fruit, right? What we can do right away that won't take so long. Just about everybody agrees that where we should start with the energy transition is coal. Basically, legislating coal out of existence, replacing all of our coal power plants with solar, wind, geothermal, what have you. That's kind of the no-brainer. Coal, obviously, is the worst climate offender. And we could do this, okay? How about home heating? In this part of the country, most of us are using natural gas. In the eastern part of the U.S., a lot of folks are heating with oil. Obviously, all of that is fossil fuels. How to do it with electricity? Well, electric heaters, the kinds of space heaters most of us are familiar with, are extremely energy inefficient. But there are better options. By the way, the strategy of electrifying more of our energy use has got to be front and center with our overall strategy for the energy transition. Remember, most of our renewable sources of energy produce electricity directly. So we have to take advantage of that bonus that we're getting wherever we possibly can by using energy in the form of electricity, wherever it's possible. So in terms of heating our homes, how about air source heat pumps? They're much more energy efficient than electric space heaters or baseboard heaters or what have you. Millions of these could be put in service across the U.S. Instantly, we could do away with a lot of our reliance on natural gas or oil. Now, obviously, somebody's got to pay for all that. So each household, presumably, would have to pony up a few thousand dollars. We're talking roughly $3,000 or $4,000 to install one of these things. So the energy transition is not going to be free. Same thing with transportation. We could drive electric cars. Electric cars are on the market. But the average person does not buy a new car every year. This is a partial solution, but it's something that is possible. It is gaining momentum. More electric cars are coming on the market every year. But if we get out of our cars and share transportation or walk or ride bicycles, that's immediately cheaper and more efficient, obviously much better. How about cooking? Again, electrify everything we possibly can. How about our food system? Our food system is a huge energy user, and we're going to have to transform our food system in pretty profound ways, because currently our food system depends a lot on oil for inputs like transporting, you know, fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides to the farm. The fertilizers are mostly made from natural gas. The pesticides and herbicides are mostly made from oil or oil byproducts. So all of that has got to change. Organic agriculture is our option there. So we need basically to transition our whole food system to one that is not dependent on these fossil fuel inputs, and it's also much more localized. So instead of shipping our foods for, you know, average of 1,500 miles, we're growing more of our food locally and reducing processing and packaging, because this is actually a surprisingly large contributor to the energy footprint of our food. Okay, that's the easy stuff. And if we did all of this easy stuff, we could probably reduce our reliance on fossil fuels by, say, roughly 40%. It's really impossible to to total it up and get to an exact number, but let's say 40%. So what's in the next swath here of the harder stuff? Well, here we're talking about not just coal, but also natural gas. Now, why is that going to be harder than coal? Because right now we use natural gas peaking plants in order to buffer the intermittency of solar and wind. If suddenly, you know, you don't have the wind power or the solar power, but you have electricity demand, you fire up the natural gas peaking plant. And that's actually going to be a more important strategy as solar and wind make up a larger and larger proportion of our total electricity supply. But if we want to get natural gas out of the picture, because it's still a fossil fuel, what do we do in that case? Well, we're going to need energy storage. Batteries are actually an inherently inefficient way of storing electricity. Now, everyone's gotten excited in the last year or so about the Tesla batteries and some improvements in battery storage efficiency and cost and so on. Yeah, batteries are getting better, but if you look at the theoretical maximum efficiency of chemical storage of electricity, it's still way below other options for energy storage. Our most efficient option from the standpoint of cost is storing electricity in reservoirs. You know, just pump water uphill when you have excess electricity into reservoirs and let it flow back downhill through turbines. But we don't have enough reservoirs. You know, you have to have the right topography in order to make optimum use of that energy storage. So, you know, right now, we really don't have the possibility of storing enough energy for long enough to get rid of natural gas. In the transport sector, we talked about electric cars, but cars are inherently energy inefficient. I mean, in most cases, with an automobile, you're talking about a couple of tons of metal and glass and plastic and rubber that you have to move around in order to transport one human being, right? That's inherently very inefficient. So there, we have more efficient ways of moving people, like public transportation, but it's going to be more expensive to build a lot of public transit, and it's going to take some time. So that's why this is in the second level of difficulty. We've got to do it and change our habits and our expectations about mobility. Well, what about all the stuff that we ship around the world? We could add kite sails to container ships, and they do make the ships much more energy efficient, but they don't do away with the need for fuel oil altogether. Okay, so really, if we're going to do away with fuel oil altogether and go to sailing ships, we're really talking about reducing the scale of global trade quite dramatically. That's why this is not in level one. We're starting to get into harder stuff. And how about our buildings? Okay, slapping an air source heat pump onto the side of a building is a good idea, but that's not enough either. We're going to have to redesign and retrofit millions of houses and public spaces across this country to make them much, much more energy efficient. Now, there are ways of doing this. In Germany, there's what's called the passive house movement. And it's actually using technology and principles developed here in the United States back in the 1970s during, you know, the energy crises of many years ago. But basically, this is using daylighting and super insulation and heat sinks and so on to reduce the energy usage in a typical building by about 90 to 95%. So why don't we make all of our building regulations require passive house standards? This is starting to be done in Europe. Not so much here in the U.S. so far. There are 20,000 passive house buildings that have been constructed in Germany. here in the United States, more like 20. So that's level two. And if we do all the stuff in level two, we might be able to get to like 80% reduction in reliance on fossil fuels. So now we're down to the really hard stuff. How about building construction? What do we use for building construction? A lot of steel and concrete. Well, it turns out that steel and concrete are really fossil fuel intensive. Making cement, we do it in giant kilns that are heated to about 1,500 degrees centigrade. And we do that with fossil fuels. Now, in principle, it would be possible to produce that kind of industrial high heat using hydrogen or electricity. But it would probably be a lot more expensive, and we would have to completely redesign the process. Nobody's doing that right now. We could be making rubber with tree sap again, rather than using oil for synthetic rubber. But how much tree sap do we have? And, you know, how much would it cost to do that? So we have to look probably at reducing the total material throughput of the economy, you know, the amount of cement and steel and mined materials that we're using. A lot of manufacturing is done with electricity, so that's good. We've already got that electrified. But the materials that we use in manufacturing very often come from mining, and those mined materials are very often shipped very long distances. All of that is dependent on fossil fuels. Now, again, we could imagine these giant mining machines running on solar or wind electricity, probably not with batteries, because batteries just don't have the energy density. But, you know, we could have electric cables running to these machines. It's possible to do. But again, nobody's doing it now, and it's likely to be more expensive, and it will be very difficult to do this on the scale that we're currently doing it. And then what about the materials that we use that are made from fossil fuels? All the petrochemicals and plastics that make their way into, you know, everything from clothing to containers to communications devices. So extracting all of those materials or finding renewable substitutes, we have a lot of work to do. We're talking about a world of smaller scale in terms of production and consumption, probably more labor in many production processes. We're talking about much more recycled natural materials, reusing and repairing things rather than throwing them away. Essentially, what this looks like is a completely new economic model. Over the last century or so, we've gotten used to the economic model called consumerism. And this started back in the 1920s and 30s and 50s, really. We had then the problem of overproduction. With cheap fossil fuels, we could make stuff faster than people were accustomed to buying it. So the solution to that was to talk people into buying more stuff than they thought they needed. So we invented an advertising industry to do that, and consumer credit industry, loaning people money so they could afford to buy stuff that they couldn't buy. We created a consumer economy characterized by planned obsolescence. The whole idea was to get everybody to buy as much stuff as they could. Well, we're moving into something that's almost entirely the opposite, a conserver economy, where the incentive will have to be somehow, one way or another, to get people to reuse, recycle, and remanufacture stuff. Now, how do we do that financially, economically, in terms of jobs and so on? This is to be determined, but it's going to be a big deal. This will be the economic transformation of the remainder of our lifetime. Now, when David Fridley and I looked at the communications sector, we found this is definitely level three. A lot of the assembly processes, again, use electricity, no problem. You can power those with solar, wind, or whatever your source of electricity, no problem. But the high heat processes for producing the materials and the sources of the materials themselves are a big problem. Whereas now we buy a new iPhone every year or 18 months, that's not how it's going to work in the future. If we want to maintain something like an internet and cloud and cell phones and all of this kind of electronic infrastructure, we're going to have to do it in a way that is probably on a smaller scale, that looks a lot more like what the internet looks like in much poorer countries. Imagine getting a smartphone and expecting it to last for 10 or 20 years. That's the future. And then there are some things that just don't work in the renewable future, and aviation is in that category. Yes, we probably could have airplanes that run on sophisticated biofuels or on cryogenic hydrogen, but in the case of hydrogen, it would require a complete redesign of all aircraft. In the case of biofuels, we're talking about fuels that have an inherent high cost from both a dollar and an energy perspective. It will take more energy to produce these fuels than they will give us when we burn them. So we'll be having to subsidize the production of those biofuels from other energy sources, which means they're inherently very expensive. So we could have vestiges of air travel with, you know, helium blimps or, you know, a few airliners running on hydrogen or biofuels, but it's not going to look anything like the aviation industry, commercial aviation industry that we see today. And you can get some idea of where we're headed just in terms of the relative energy efficiency of different transport modes. You know, rail turns out to be very efficient in terms of moving tons per mile. We actually need to rebuild our rail networks in this country and rely much less on trucking. Now, when we get to the point of fully transitioning our food system to where it's entirely localized and organic, if we do this intelligently, there could actually be some side benefits, because it's possible to use permaculture and organic production in ways that build topsoil. Now, we've been mining topsoil using industrial agriculture, and that's actually been a very large net contributor to greenhouse gases. But if we begin building topsoil, what we're doing in the process is actually capturing and storing carbon from the atmosphere back into the soil. And so there could be a net benefit from a climate standpoint to this energy transition. And at the end of the day, when we've finished doing the level three really hard stuff, we could be in a situation where not only are we no longer adding CO2 to the atmosphere, but we're actually reducing the carbon load. Now, how much energy are we likely to have at the end of this process? That's an unknown. Again, there are too many variables, but most of the variables that David and I have looked at are ones that seem to militate in the direction of less usable energy. The question that a lot of people are asking is, could renewable energy enable us to maintain our current lifestyle? Well, as the Global Footprint Network has documented, our current lifestyle entails using the world's resources at about four times the sustainable rate. I'm talking about how we live in North America. So asking if we can maintain a North American lifestyle with renewable energy is basically asking, can we use renewable energy to continue living unsustainably? And the answer to that question is, well, not for very long. So we should be aiming for a much lower energy consumption level anyway. And if we aim for a lower level, we're much more likely to be able to meet that level of demand with intermittent sources like solar and wind that are backed up by other renewable sources like hydropower, geothermal, and the rest, which can be used as baseload, right? If we're demanding current level of energy consumption, then we create all kinds of engineering problems in terms of buffering that intermittency with storage and grid upgrades and source redundancy and so on. But you can get rid of most of those engineering nightmares just by reducing energy demand pretty dramatically, like 70 to 90%. Because then you can rely on these other sources, again, like hydro, geothermal, and so on, for baseload, and then use solar and wind for electricity that you can use when it's available. And you can schedule and time your energy consumption according to electricity availability. So that's the cheapest way of engineering the energy transition. So this is what our energy future is likely to look like. Less overall energy. Much of it will be less controllable. We will be less mobile altogether. We're not going to have aviation, and other forms of mobility will be constrained. And therefore, our economies are going to have to be much more localized. Altogether, we're not talking about a plug-and-play transition where we unplug the coal power plant, plug in a solar panel, and continue living exactly the way we're accustomed to. We're talking about a civilization reboot. As we do this, we're going to have to think about energy equity also, because all of this is going to cost a lot. So how do we pursue it? Do we just let those folks who can afford to have solar panels and wind turbines install their own energy systems, and the rest of us just rely on what we can still afford until it runs out or it's no longer available? That's one possible pathway to a renewable energy future. It will be an extremely dysfunctional pathway because all it will do is exacerbate the already extreme economic inequality that we see in this country and around the world. So if we don't want that future, we're going to have to plan for energy equity. And that's another whole lecture. So the opportunities here are sizable. We could have a much more energy-efficient economy. We could have, in fact, a more acceptable quality of life, even with much lower energy consumption per capita, if we plan for the transition and make it in a coordinated way. Obviously, we'll have a much more stable climate if we do this. Obviously, we'll have greatly reduced health and environmental impacts and costs, and we will be able to remove carbon from the atmosphere. But it's going to require a lot of investment. That means we have to make this a top priority as a society. It will require regulation. I said earlier, we have to basically regulate coal out of existence and then do that also with oil and natural gas. And we can't do that until we have alternatives ready to go. We're going to have to change behaviors and expectations, and it's going to ultimately give us an economy that looks very different from the consumer economy of the 20th century. So it's a big job. And right now, we don't have folks at the national political level talking very much about it. In fact, we have one whole party that denies that this is even a possibility or a necessity. So we have a lot of work on our hands. And where we can do this work on the local level, we can get started. And therefore, our economies are going to have to be much more localized. This is going to be a difficult, expensive, and long process. We can't do it all in 5 or 10 years. But we have to get started, and the longer we wait, the more difficult and expensive the process, and the more likely we will end up at the end of the day with a political and economic system that's much less functional than it would otherwise be.
That was Richard Heinberg. He's senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and has written extensively on energy and ecological issues. Even his first book, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, caught the attention and imagination of many. He has been quoted and interviewed by Reuters, AP, and Time magazine, and on TV in the US, Canada, Australia, and by Al Jazeera. Heinberg has also appeared in many films and TV documentaries, including Leonardo DiCaprio's 11th Hour. His animations, Don't Worry, Drive On, Who Killed Economic Growth, and 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Minutes, have been viewed by more than 1.6 million people on YouTube. He was recorded and filmed by TUC Radio at the Little Lake Grange in the small former logging town of Willits, California, on November 15, 2015. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Those of us in the first world who live relatively comfortable lives, at some level, we know that the material comfort with which we live is built on the backs of people primarily in the global south, in the third world. And we know that's inconsistent with our own moral principles. We know it violates our concern for the fundamental dignity of all people and for equality.
That's the voice of Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Robert Jensen about his book, All My Bones Shake, and society's four fundamentalisms that we need to deal with to move forward in a healthy way. So stay tuned.
We are privileged to have as our guest Dr. Robert Jensen. He teaches media law, ethics, and politics at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Get Enough, The Heart of Whiteness, Citizen of the Empire, and Right in Dissent. His latest book is All My Bones Shake. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Jensen.
Great to be with you, Sylvia.
At the root of the current political economy and ecological chaos is a national religious unrest that is thwarting our self-awareness and slowing our spiritual progress to a glacial crawl. This is a quote from the cover on your book. In our society, we seem to think of religion as the belief in some type of deity, whether that be a Christianity religion, Muslim religion, or any kind of religion. I would argue there seems to be another religion, and that is the religion of the marketplace. where we accept things as the natural result of the marketplace. And you actually covered this in your book. So for our audience, where does this come from? Where does this blind faith in the market come, and how does it manifest?
Well, of course, you're right that we talk about religion and spirituality and faith and the things that define us. But in reality, in the contemporary United States, and the truth is it's blanketed much of the world, there is a kind of market fundamentalism, an economic fundamentalism that not only claims capitalism is the best way to organize an economy, but claims it's the only way, it's the natural way. It's an attempt to make a set of human choices about how to distribute the wealth of the world as if they were natural, as if they were beyond critique. And that's a kind of core definition of fundamentalism, a belief in a set of principles with absolute certainty in a way that can't be challenged. But, of course, an economy is a set of human choices. Why do we accept this market fundamentalism? Well, part of it is simply the effort that has been put into a propaganda system by mostly a relatively small elite to get ordinary people to believe that the incredibly unequal distribution of wealth in the world is somehow unavoidable. But, of course, we know it's not. And we know that we have within our grasp, if we were to do so, ways to devise an economy that would not be perfect, that would still require a lot of struggle, but would not produce the profound inequality which now structures the world economy. I would just remind listeners that as we speak, about half the world's population, according to the World Bank, more than 3 billion people on this planet today live on less than $2.50 a day U.S. for everything, food, shelter, education, medical. That is, half the population lives in a kind of abject poverty. I would want to believe that that is not our only option, that there are other ways to devise an economy. And I think, paradoxically, although in this country many people who identify as Christians also accept this market fundamentalism, I think Christianity is a source of resistance to this fundamentalism. And in the progressive fashioning of an understanding of Christianity, I think there is a lot of hope.
One of the things you address in your book is you say there are four fundamentalisms. So I wonder, you talked about the market fundamentalism and how we see this invisible hand sort of fixing everything and the market dictating the choices. So it implies that citizens have choices. So perhaps we should start by addressing the issue of choice then, because if you are a Haitian, you're choices are very different than if you are a worker in Canada or the U.S. So how is this constructed and maintained, this myth of equality and democracy in our society?
Well, of course, first of all, we should recognize that within the contemporary corporate capitalist system, it's not a complete myth. There is some freedom to choose, and there is some movement from people who begin in low socioeconomic places and rise up. That is, there is a kernel of truth to the notion in capitalism that anybody can make it. Certainly there are people who were raised poor who became wealthy. Certainly there is some level of choice in the system. But the question is, does everyone have meaningful choices with the kind of equality that makes it possible to truly choose? And the answer there is, of course, no, because capitalism has been and always will be, from my point of view, a wealth-concentrating system. And kind of the lie of capitalism is the idea that everybody can make it. But, of course, the system is premised on not everyone making it. And when we look across time and space, we see that historically that relatively small elite, which has for the most part been concentrated in the first world, in Europe, the United States, Japan, a few other places, has used its power. It's used force, violence, coercion. It's used all of that to maintain that inequality. Well, I think when you step back and look at the whole system, one sees that capitalism is, in fact, inconsistent with democracy, because the way capitalism concentrates wealth leads to a concentration of political power. One can see that capitalism is inconsistent with our own principles and values about what it means to be a human being. A belief in the dignity of all people, a belief in equality. And for those reasons, I think capitalism is fundamentally incompatible with Christianity. I think to take seriously the text and the tradition of the Christian faith is to be anti-capitalist. And in fact, if one looks back at the early Christians in the first two or three centuries after Christ was killed, you see that many people in that era believed that to be a Christian was to live communally, to share, to renounce private property. Well, that's not capitalism, in case anybody isn't clear. All right, so the Christian tradition itself is rooted in a rejection of the inequality and materialism that defines capitalism. I think the principles of Christianity, when appropriately understood today, would lead to a rejection of the current capitalist system. And that's why in the book I try to root myself in that Christian tradition, which is the tradition of the culture I come out of. And I think the struggle to define what that Christianity means is very important.
You brought two very important points, and I think that's how religious has been sort of thwarted to be in favor of capital and economic fundamental principles. And I just want to point out that I recently interviewed Bruce Gagnon. He pointed out that, you know, with the election of President Obama, everyone was celebrating a shift and change. And yet, he says, you know, in 1 year, President Obama has done what no other Republican has ever done in the history of the U.S. And he turned $12.3 trillion in bailouts. Nine out of every $10 was given to the banks. And I'm reminded of the story in the Bible where Jesus spoke against this. And this idea that we accept certain policies blindly, I think, needs to be addressed. I'm trying to reconcile the fact that we take this as a, you know, without challenging. On one hand, we say the bailouts needed to be given. Why? Who profits in an economic crisis? Who's profiting out of the massive military budgets that are being issued? So it seems to me there's a structure behind this. Can you speak to this?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Of course, in times of crisis, there is always a push on the part of elites to define the crisis as unmanageable without immediate action from the top. And, of course, sometimes that's true. If your country is being invaded by another country, perhaps that might be true. But with an economic crisis like the one we just lived through, or are still living through, there was another option, and that option was to rethink the fundamental nature of the system, to use the crisis not simply to shore up and reinforce the inequality in the existing system, but to ask, is this a moment where we can devise something new? And that can happen with the input of everyone. There could have just as easily been a process when the subprime mortgage crisis hit to convene a kind of national conversation about what we want in an economy. And I think that the reason that didn't happen was not because it was impossible, but because people with power didn't want it to happen. And I think the tension around this is mounting. Ordinary people increasingly, even people who 5-10 years ago would have endorsed the capitalist system in the United States on the assumption that it would provide for them, are now seeing that the people who run that capitalist system really don't care about ordinary people, and that ordinary people are starting to push back and to recognize their real fate in that system. Now, I think the really important moment for those of us who consider ourselves politically active or organizers or community activists is, can we marshal that resentment into positive channels to challenge the system? You know, Barack Obama happens to be the guy running things at the moment, but it's not the guy running things at the moment in Washington who really holds power. It's the people who control the productive capacity of the country, the capitalists in that sense, the owners and the high-level managers. And we have to challenge them. And then eventually, if we're successful, we give the Barack Obamas of the world a choice. You either sink your fate in with the people, or you ally yourself with the wealthy and the privileged, and it's a choice then politicians have to make. You know, all of this is a long-term struggle that's been going on for decades, centuries, in which ordinary people have been trying to take control of our own lives. And this is a moment where I think there are things possible precisely because of the crisis.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the fundamentalism, this fundamentalism that you speak of in your book, of the state, this nationalism that promotes or sometimes blinds people to the actions of their government. How does this unfold? And you know, because it seems every empire has always justified whatever crimes they commit as being in the interest of the people, this sort of benevolent empire. How does it manifest, and why should we be aware of it and fight against it?
I think you're, again, hitting on an incredibly important subject, especially here in the United States, which is kind of the empire of the modern world at this point. You know, as you point out, most imperial powers in the past, whether it was Britain, France, you know, for a brief time, Germany, Russia, they often justified their crimes around the world, the crimes that exploited the resources of other places and oppressed the people of those places. They justified those crimes as somehow being in the interests of advancing civilization, of civilizing the natives. These are very, you know, obvious justifications and failed justifications. Of course, no serious person would believe them today. Yet here in the United States, we have our own imperial justifications, mostly around the idea of bringing democracy to other parts of the world. Well, we have to break down that fundamentalism, that sort of unthinking acceptance of a set of principles that really don't conform to reality. Does the United States bring democracy to the world? Well, I think we can look across the board, especially in the post-World War II era at U.S. interventions, and see that, in fact, the United States has done more to thwart democracy in other parts of the world than to advance it. So just as we have to break down the notion that markets and capitalism are inevitable, that fundamentalism must be challenged. So must the fundamentalism around the special role of the United States, the idea that the United States, by definition, is always doing good in the world. Well, a lot of people in the United States hold on to that fundamentalist notion as well. And I think all we're saying is that, you know, reality does not conform to fundamentalist notions. Reality is complex. Reality has a historical base that we have to try to understand. Reality includes an honest accounting of power, privilege, and oppression. And when we do that, of course, the fundamentalism melts away, just as I think it does in the religious arena, that when you fully understand the complexity of the human experience, it's hard to hold on to fundamentalisms, and that's what we have to do, is kind of ruthlessly tell the truth about this country, this economy, and our place in the world.
Your book also talks about the technological fundamentalism, and I want to address this because we are living in an era of, particularly in Latin America, of incredible aggression. We see the coup in Honduras taking place, and the world has stood up and denounced the coup. And in many cases, we defend these policies as this developmental idea. And technology sort of goes hand in hand. But I think technology in the interest of whom? And technology for whom? So what do you mean by the technological fundamentalism? How do you see it being counterintuitive to a society that is inclusive and pluralistic?
I think here the critique and concern about a kind of high-energy, high-technology life is rapidly spreading. The one thing we know without question is that the fundamental health of the ecosystem that makes our own lives possible is in dramatic decline, and that decline is overwhelmingly because of human intervention into the ecosystem in ways that are not sustainable. It's the way we farm. It's the way we extract materials from the world. It's the way we dump toxins back into that world. Everyone understands, at least everyone who's willing to tell the truth, that we have created a system based on the high energy potential of coal, oil, and natural gas, and the technological advances that have come with that, that we based a system on an unsustainable relationship to the earth. Now, what I call, and others have called, technological fundamentalism is really the belief that whatever problems have come from that high-energy, high-technology world can be fixed with simply more high-energy, high-technology. And you see this over and over again. We talk about the energy problem, and there is a scrambling to believe that we can invent new ways of creating as much energy as coal, oil, and natural gas have provided, even though That's an extremely contentious claim. We see the problems created, such as global warming, you know, the loss of the ozone layer, all these things. And instead of asking a fundamental question, which is, should human beings adjust the way we interact in the world, lower our expectations for energy use and consumption, to try and bring our way of living back into some sort of balance with the larger world? That question is never really considered, and all that we talk about in the dominant culture is how to find new high-energy, high-technology solutions to the problems that high-energy, high-technology has created. And that may end up being the most dangerous fundamentalism. I think, you know, religious fundamentalism is dangerous. We see the negative consequences when people have an unthinking belief in the absolute righteousness of a religious system. We talked about the problems of market fundamentalism, of national fundamentalism. But with technological fundamentalism, unfortunately, we're not just talking about the inequality within the human family. We're talking about whether the human family can continue to live in any sustainable way on this planet. And so many of us are concerned that this reflexive technological fundamentalism, this belief that technology will always save us, whether that might end up being the most dangerous fundamentalism of them all.
I think in society we tend to be selective as to what we consider to be important. And one of the ways militarism has been able to advance is by creating this fear of the other in society. And who are the other? Those who we do not recognize being equal to us or similar to us, whether that be skin or language or, you know, whatever we define as different. What do we lose when we ignore inequity, injustice in the pursuit of our goals for development or an improved quality of life? What do we lose in the long run?
Well, I think the answer is quite simple. We lose our own humanity. Those of us in the first world who live relatively comfortable lives, at some level we know that the material comfort with which we live is built on the backs of people primarily in the global south, in the third world. And we know that's inconsistent with our own moral principles. We know it violates our concern for the fundamental dignity of all people and for equality. Yet the material comfort with which we live often allows us to ignore that. But I think when we do ignore that, in a very basic way, we lose some of our own humanity. And here, I think, is a place where traditional religion actually can help. Because if you think about whether it's Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, all of them are, at their core, I believe, are a call to recognize the universal nature of the human family. That is, all of them include principles that remind us that the value of my life, sitting here in the United States today, is of no greater or lesser value than the lives of people across the world. That person who might be living in sub-Saharan Africa on less than $2.50 a day, that person has the same moral value as I do, that person's child has the same moral value as my child. That is the universalizing call of religion, and it's clearly at the core of the Christian faith. Now, the problem, of course, is that religion can also be a way in which we distance ourselves from other human beings. That is, religion, although I think it is a call to the universal, also often leads people to draw the artificial boundaries you're talking about. Well, there's me and my group, the good Christians, and then there's all the sinners out in the world. And you can see how religion is, from my point of view, perverted to create barriers instead of break down those barriers. But again, I think that's why, for those of us who have an interest in struggling over the definition of Christianity and other faith traditions, we have a lot of work we can do not to invent a new religion, but simply to say it's time in the prophetic sense, that it's time to honor the true values of the religion, to honor that universal conception of the human family. All of that's within our grasp. There's a tradition, there's a text, there's a space that we call church where we can come together and do this. And I think that's, for me at least, the animating spirit behind my own interest in religion.
You, in your book, talk about power over in a dead world. What do you mean by power over, and what are the alternatives?
When we think about the question of power, in conventional terms, power is defined as the ability to make people do what they would otherwise not do. I have power over you, Sylvia, if I can make you do things you would otherwise not do. And that's what we tend to call power over. And, of course, power over is real. It operates in the world. It often has disastrous consequences. But we can also think about power as power with. That is, my power is not over you. It's with you. It's in the collaborative, creative possibilities of you and I combining forces. And that's a different sense of power. That's the power, I think, that makes it possible to imagine a decent future. The power over, I believe, can lead only to a dead world. And I would make the argument right now that in the United States, given the values of this national fundamentalism and the market fundamentalism, often connected to a very reactionary religious fundamentalism, I would describe that as a dead culture, a culture that has no capacity to generate creativity and to generate life. All it can do is extract from others, which leads to death. So I know it sounds rather perhaps dramatic, but I really do think in many profound ways in the contemporary United States, we live in a dead culture, a culture that hangs on to ideas that are no longer consistent with reality, that hangs on to systems that are not consistent with a decent future. And I think we have to create something new. My own view is that that's not likely to happen in Washington, D.C. or on Wall Street in the centers of power. It's going to happen at the margins in places like Austin, Texas, where I live, where, you know, as we speak, we're working to acquire a building for a new community center. We're working to create some worker-owned cooperatives where people can control their own economic life. We're talking about resisting, you know, racism and sexism. We're talking about coming together in this sense of power with, not to control each other, but to try and find ways to create something new. And that's where I think the real hope for the future lies.
What do we need to create this new society that you describe?
Well, I think we need a 12-pack of beer and some barbecue. No, I'm kidding. That's the solution to everything in Texas. Just get a 12-pack of beer and some barbecue and everything will be fine. What does it take? Well, I think it takes, first of all, a kind of honesty to confront the very dire circumstances we find ourselves in. And beyond that, I think it takes a sense of hope. And by hope, I don't mean unrealistic, overly optimistic assessments. I think, you know, people have used the term a kind of stubborn hope, a hope that won't give up even when things are looking bleak. And I think we should tell the truth. Things do look pretty bleak in this country at the moment. Much of the population is in the grips of these fundamentalisms. Yet I think that we rescue our own humanity, especially those of us with privilege. And I have a lot of privilege. I'm white. I'm male. I'm professionally educated and employed. You know, the way I'm going to save my own humanity is not by holding on to my privilege or holding on to my resources. It's going to be coming into spaces where I willingly give up those resources in a collaboration with others. That's how we save ourselves. You know, sometimes people look at the political work I do and they think somehow I'm this very noble person. And the fact is I'm probably the most selfish human being I know. I do this work because I want to, in a sense, save my own life. I want to create or help create a world in which I can be fully human. And the world we live in right now does not allow that. The world we live in closes off so many avenues for us to express our own humanity. It keeps us trapped in the corporate world. It keeps us trapped in conventional politics. It keeps us trapped in a commodified commercial culture that is always telling us to buy, buy, buy.
I was speaking to a journalist from Honduras. Gerardo Torres is a young man who started a movement called Los Necios, the stubborn. And they speak precisely what you're talking about, this stubborn hope, this idea that although you are constantly told you don't have a right to have those dreams, he says we're going to have them and we're going to define those who tell us we do not have the right to pursue a society with dignity and, you know, just a decent quality of life. What inspires you? What inspires your work to continue to struggle?
Well, I can tell you that's very easy. What inspires me is the people like you just described. Here in Austin, I've been incredibly fortunate to work with people, often younger people, people from what we call traditionally minority communities, people from parts of society that are not as wealthy, and I watch them struggle against much greater obstacles than I face myself, and I see them struggling and struggling joyously. You know, as someone who's older and more established and materially in a much more comfortable position, what I've discovered is when I go to those people and say, I want to join you in your struggle, I want to commit my own time and resources to the projects that you have going, that, as I said, I benefit tremendously. This is what gives my own life meaning. It's what deepens my own sense of my own humanity. There's inspiration every time we turn the corner. We just have to be willing to see it.
Thank you so much for joining us. For people who want to read your book, All My Bones Shake, is an amazing book. It really challenges to look at our values and our own beliefs and how they contribute or perpetuate a system of injustice and what can we do about it. So how can people access your book?
Well, the easiest way to find me, if you have access to a computer, is just to Google my name, Robert Jensen, and the first page that comes up will be mine.
Thank you again for joining us.
Great to be with you, Sylvia. Thanks.
Take care.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.